ان انت just as a starting point to say welcome to the delegation from the Pacific Theater and the AG's office. We had asked the AG's office, based on our previous interactions with other centers, based on the concerns that we had on the finances, and I'm alleged that there's a presentation that is going to assist us understand those issues that we have concern on. Without any waste of time, I'm going to ask our chairperson to introduce the delegation that she's leading, and then we'll take the presentation from the AGs later. Can you have the mic on when you speak? Thank you very much.
Good morning to all. Good morning. I can sit. Yeah, I look taller sitting down. Firstly, a pleasure to meet you. My name is Robert Kappa. I am the chairman of FACET. It's my delight to welcome, to introduce to you Mr. Seng Molloy, who is our deputy chairperson. Sitting next to her is Asha Laku, our chief financial officer, our CFO. Our CEO, Cheryl James, who is probably our most key person, very important. Our matter of ego as often as I can. And sitting at the end is Nadine Cater, who is our Chief Operations Officer, our COO. These three people represent our management team, on whom we rely and worship. Without them, the management board is nothing.
Thank you very much, honorable members. I think we are going to start with taking the presentation. With presenting, I would allow the chairperson to give us an overview of what are the key issues that we want us to note, especially from governance point of view, and then we'll allow the team to lead the presentation. I'm just trying to understand if there's any difference between the two documents that you've sent. There's a document that you've circulated for us before, and this one I just found here on the table before we started.
Chairperson, thank you very much. The document that you received before is a copy of our annual report, and it's the document we'll be talking to today. The document that we circulated at the start of the meeting is a history of 10 years of FACET's delivery. So it's a summary of a decade of delivery from the CETA. Thank you.
Okay, so we're focusing on the other one is the additional document. I'm going to ask you to note that we have read your report. It has been sent to us. So when presenting, highlight key issues and don't dwell much. You have about 15 minutes to do the presentation for us. Thank you very much. You can start, the board chairperson. Over to you.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Much as I would like to give the presentation, you get far greater insight if you listen to our CEO, Cheryl, so we've asked her to do the presentation for us.
Now we want you to give us an overview from your side as the board chairperson of the performance of the CETA from governance point of view. So surely there should be something that you can highlight before the CEO gets to operational issues. Because there are governance issues, isn't it, on the reports that are flagged. And that's why you'd have the chairperson's remarks on the annual report.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I'm prepared for this, and I do apologize. While we move quickly on to the appropriate one. Okay, as far as governance is concerned, we're very proud to let you know that we have had an unqualified audit report for 10 years. We have a very good relationship with the Auditor General, and we appreciate the input they give us in ensuring that we maintain that unqualified audit report. We believe strongly in good corporate governance, and to do that, we make sure that we assess our management board and our operations constantly. We self-assess and have assessment by others, and we regularly check ourselves to make sure that we are performing up to standard. We also make sure that we align to the King's Three, because this is important from not just a corporate governance, but also from a disclosure point of view, to make sure that we are doing the right things. We support extending our audit to go beyond the statutory minimum, and we make sure that we have a clean audit report the whole time. anything else you would like to know, Madam Chair?
That's fine. If that's what you want to brief the committee on, we can proceed with this.
That's fine. Thank you.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. I think if we can get into the heart of the presentation, we've just, as a slide, given you an overview of the sections that we're going to be covering. As our first opportunity to be briefing the Portfolio Committee on Higher Education and Training, we're just going to have a quick look at the FACET sector profile and the sector that we represent in terms of upskilling the youth of our country. A quick look at financial information and governance, which is in our annual report, and you've had an opportunity to have a look at it. A quick look at the performance indicators and the targets that we set and the interventions that we put in place to try and achieve these targets. But the bulk of our presentation is going to focus on actual delivery, regional impact, rural reach, decent work for young people, and one of the strengths of FACET that we believe that's led to our 10-year success, which is the very strong partnership model that we've developed. I think moving on, if we have a look at the sector, the FACET sector is predominantly made up of accounting and auditing firms. They represent 63% of the firms in the FACET sector and 49% of the employees. But I think very, very importantly, if we look at FACET sector, is a very, very strong and close link to government departments. If you look at SARS, if you look at the Auditor General, if you look at National Treasury, they are all members of FACET, and their employees make up 14% of our constituency. So we have a slightly different focus in terms of having to look after the public sector in our interventions as well. Another interesting statistic in the FACET sector is that the majority of organizations in the FACET sector employ less than 50 people. So only 4% of organizations in the FACET sector employ over 50 people. So 96% of our sector is SMME. And we need to look at how we address the SMME needs, particularly in an economy like ours where we know that growth and job opportunities are going to come from growing those small practices into medium practices. We also see that a large proportion of our employees work in organizations that employ 1 to 50 people. So it's predominantly a sector where it's very small professional practices with the opportunity to take on one or two learners, and that's the market that we've got to focus on. If we look at the geographic distribution, I think it's what you would expect in a professional sector where we're looking after accountants, the stockbroking environment, management consulting, where we see that about 80% of the employees in our sector are working in Gauteng, KwaZulu-Natal, and the Western Cape. But you'll also see that we do have a split of people across all 9 of our provinces, and that we find accountants running small practices in very small cities and sometimes in rural areas. And we have an obligation to look after those people as well. And Nadine, when she looks at delivery, will highlight the kind of interventions we have for small practitioners in small towns. If we look at the race and gender breakdown of the FACET sector, you will see that it's still a challenge that the sector faces and that the professions within our sector face in terms of getting the race breakdown of our sector to be equal to the demographics of our country. But we have definitely made strides in the work that FACET does in that regard. If we look at our learner numbers, when we started our learnership interventions in 2002, 25% of our learners were black. At the end of 2009, 52% of our learners are black. So we are definitely seeing a shift in the racial and gender profile within our sector. That shift has not manifested itself yet in the higher levels of the profession, if we look at management and professional level. And one of the reasons for that is it takes the average professional in this sector 7 to 10 years to qualify. So young people that we started to help in 2002 are only just starting to qualify now, and then we would need to see those young people given a couple of years of experience before they can start moving into the senior management positions. We're also aware that the gender imbalance also exists at the management and professional levels, and you'll see later that some of our interventions also address that gender imbalance. Looking quickly at the financial information, a couple of points that I'd like to point out to you is that you'll see that our expense as a percentage of skills development levy income last year was sitting at 123%, and that we had a deficit at FACET of 30 million rand. Now, that doesn't mean that you need to be concerned and that we're spending money that we don't have. Effectively, what it means is we are starting to be able to spend previous years' surpluses a lot quicker. So we don't have large amounts of money sitting around in FACET bank accounts. The majority of projects that we fund at FACET are 3 to 4 year projects because of the nature of the sector. We need to keep that money in trust in the first year that we allocate it, and we're starting to see delivery on those projects accelerating now. So a deficit in a CETA environment is actually a very good thing. I think importantly, we also need to note that our admin expenditure is well below the 10% limit contained in the legislation, and we're sitting at just under 8%. So we try and run a lean and mean admin machine to make sure that the majority of the funding is available for young people who are looking for opportunities. Also, all of our unspent money has all been allocated, and it is all committed. But as I said earlier on, a number of the interventions that we support are 3 to 4 year interventions, and we're not able to spend that in the year in which we allocate it. I think Robert has already given you an overview of the governance. I would just like to highlight one more point, is that FACET is involved this year in a very strong exercise of aligning the CETA's governance to the requirements of King 3, because King 3 has just come out, and we need to make sure that we're at the forefront of governance issues because of the sector we represent, and we're currently just finishing an internal audit to see where the gaps are between what the CETA currently does and the requirements of King 3, so we can close those gaps in the years going forward. With regard to our national skills development strategy targets, I think you can see, and they're in our annual report, that all of the targets that we've set for the financial year we're looking at have been met or exceeded. But I think more important than looking at the actual numbers is to give you a little bit of background in terms of why we believe this has been possible. And we believe that the backbone of any CETA's success is research. We have to focus a lot of our effort on researching what the skills development needs in our sector are, so that those interventions that we put in place are able to address the skills shortages needs, and we focus our alignment and our funding in the right way. And I think in this way we've seen that we've had huge success, and the 10-year book will show you this, in terms of making sure that the skills we identify to support meet the actual skills shortages and skills needs of the sector out there. But more importantly, what does this actually mean? We see a lot of figures in annual reports, we see finances, we see predetermined objectives, but we always forget to have a look at the lives of the young people that we're actually making a difference with. And before I hand over to Nadine, who's going to be looking at the actual interventions, I'd just like to share a quick story with you. In 2002, FACET identified that a number of learners who were studying at Cedar City campus were experiencing difficulties when they were closing down the business degree at Cedar City campus, and those young people were going to be left with nowhere to go. And we picked those young people up, and one of the young people we picked up was a chap called Robert Zwani. And Robert had come from a very poor background in Limpopo, and he'd ended up at Cedar City campus because he had no money to go to university. We funded Robert together with SICA, the South African Institute of Chartered Accountants, and the Tachuka Project, and Robert completed his undergraduate and his postgraduate degree in the 4 years at UJ. what was very interesting about Robert is that his first year of articles, he actually did academic articles. So he stayed on at the university doing a master's degree and lecturing first-year students. He then left and he went and did the remaining of his articles with PwC, and he completed his chartered accountant qualification, and he qualified in the minimum period that anybody can qualify. But the most surprising thing about Robert is that Robert has left the profession. He left PwC, and he has gone back to UJ as a first-year lecturer, and he's living in the Tituka Hostel with other first-year disadvantaged learners who are coming through the same path that he's going on. And I think those are the stories that we often don't hear about CETAs. That here was a young man who had every single future in front of him. He could have earned hundreds of thousands of rands as a qualified chartered accountant. And he's chosen to go back and give to young people the same opportunity that FACET had given him 8 or 9 years ago. And I think those are the success stories that we sometimes forget about. We can go through a whole session like this, speaking about CETAs, but never speaking about learners. And I think we need to just ground ourselves and remember that the CETAs are here first and foremost for young learners and the opportunities we can give them. So I'm now going to hand over to Nadine, who's going to take you through some of the other interventions that we've put in place, and hopefully to show you that we haven't got one Robert, but in the FACET sector, we've got 30,000 Roberts. Thank you.
Thank you, Cheryl. Good morning, members. As Cheryl's indicated, once FACET has done the research, what we try and do is by looking at what the actual skill shortages are, we try and match interventions that try and address those shortages. So for the next two slides, I'm going to go through some of those very quickly. The learnership system at FACET has proved very successful. It allows learners to get the double-edged sword of having an academic qualification and a practical qualification. Currently, we have 4,200 learners registered and have completed learnerships. We find that all the learners who complete the learnerships in the FACET sector, 100% of them are placed, and this bodes very well for future employment opportunities. What's very important is that 52% of these learners are black. That 52% may not seem good just on the surface, but as Cheryl's indicated, it's a 100% increase from what we used to have in 2002, where only 25% of those learners coming into the sector were black learners. We're talking about a total of 39,000 learners over the 10 years. The development project is interesting because it now targets unemployed graduates, and we're fully aware that that's one of the main skill shortages in the country. We've got people with a qualification, but they're not necessarily getting the work experience. With our service providers, we recruit those unemployed graduates. We place them on work readiness programs for anything from 12 weeks, sometimes for 6 months. That enables them to get work ready, and therefore we can present them back to the sector and back to employers as people that are ready to work and ready to hit the ground running. We've spent, as you can see, $310 million on those projects over the last 10 years and have managed to assist 11,000 learners who were previously unemployed graduates to come into the FACET sector and obtain a qualification. The lifelong learning intervention focuses now on our employees that are currently employed in the sector. You may wonder why this is important. Remember that the FACET sector includes a lot of professional people, stockbrokers, accountants, tax practitioners, bookkeepers. It's very important for them to maintain their professional standards. I'm sure you wouldn't want to go to a tax practitioner that is not up to date with the latest tax law and get your tax return wrong. So we keep those people up to date, maintain their standard, because these are also the people who are mentoring our new learners and training them into the learnership. So if their standard is not world-class and globally related, we won't have the quality of training that we require to develop these young people into the profession. FACET works with three specific grants, and the grants are quite important. The first grant is a mandatory grant, And the fact that 87% of our employers claim back the grant is quite phenomenal. This means that 87% of our employers are actually planning their training and planning their interventions and reporting to FACET on that. That means that they're taking training and skill development quite seriously. Employers are also able to claim what is called a learnership cash grant. So here we're saying to the employer, here's your unemployed learner in place on the work readiness program, and here we're giving you a grant of up to 27,000 rand per learner to assist you to incorporate that learner into your organization. We only give the learnership cash grant to black learners and to learners who have a disability. So we have managed to encourage employers where the profile of the sector was previously very white Afrikaans male. We have encouraged those employers in as far afield as Tenneen and Potchefstroom and Welkom to actually take black learners into their practice. As Cheryl has indicated, the sector is largely made up of small and medium employers. And we find that that's where the growth opportunity really is, where those employers are able to take one or two extra learners and, in a sense, build their client base with the new learners. The strategic cash grant allows employers to maintain a system where they can assist learners with other interventions, including bursaries, while they are working at the employer or while they are still at university. The strategic cash grant also facilitates other work experience where the employer takes learners on during vacation work or even places them on a short kind of internship. So the grants are trying to facilitate the learner getting into the workplace and actually getting some of the work experience, where we find that there's quite a big skill shortage in that area. The career guidance campaign is very exciting and new for FACET. The idea is that once we've done all that research and we now know what the skill shortages are, we also know which careers young people should be choosing. So it's important for us to go out and actually inform them and tell them what those careers are. We often get used to the very standard careers, like your chartered accountant, your engineer, your doctor, etc. It's important for our young people to know that there are other opportunities in the sector. So we go and tell them that they could also be accounting officers, bookkeepers, stockbrokers, even debt collectors or management consultants, to give them the opportunity to choose a career where we know we can develop them and assist them and therefore for them later to gain a meaningful employment. So we try and start at the school level, starting to give them career guidance for the career pamphlet. We also then tap into them at a university through exhibitions and campaigns, and we're also trying to work with the FET colleges to give them all the information they need for their career choices. The last but not least intervention is a disability toolkit. Here we realize that although we're giving employers grants and assistance in terms of finances to finance a learner with a disability, they were still lacking some of the practical guidance that they needed when they were trying to recruit or incorporate people with disabilities, and also to demystify some of the problems they think they will have with learners with a disability. So this is the disability toolkit is really the HR person in the FACET sector was able to use it as a guideline in terms of how to work with people and learners that have disabilities, where to find them, what resources to look at, and how to plan for the incorporation into the workplace. All of the interventions that we've mentioned are available across all of the regions in the country. What we've tried to do with this slide is sign total the number of learners that have gained from the interventions in the different provinces and the corresponding money that we've managed to spend. So when you see numbers in the Eastern Cape of 1,805, that includes our learners on learnerships, learners that have managed to benefit from a learnership cash grant, people that have attended our lifelong learning, as well as learners that may have been given a bursary to the strategic cash grant. As you can see, there are still high numbers in the main provinces, which seems to be Gauteng, your KwaZulu-Natal, and your Western Cape. But we are pleased to note that we are still reaching the other provinces and learners and employers in other provinces. Despite the provincial reach, we're aware that there there still needs to be a reach within the province, deeper into some of the rural areas. Again, we've listed some of the interventions, but I'd just like to highlight some of the areas where our learners, where we've recruited learners or we've managed to present seminars. In terms of development projects, if you remember, these are unemployed graduates that we try and recruit and place them on a work readiness program. We have managed to recruit learners from as far afield as Giani, Sanin, Polokwane, Mthatha, Mzimkulu, and so on. So we are finding these unemployed graduates. We're able to bring them to the main centers, train them in work readiness, and we try as far as possible to place them back into their original areas. Robert Zwani, for instance, went back and did extra lessons at the school where he grew up. We do realize that the ability for them to go back does also depend on enough economic activity in that particular area. So, for instance, it would be very difficult for a stockbroker to function in an area that's not close to a large company or a stock exchange. But we find with a debt collector's environment, for instance, a debt collector could easily set up in Port Elizabeth or Mthatha because of the nature of debt collecting is very much a call center-based activity. Also, we're very fortunate that an accountant or a bookkeeper you'll find in almost any town, because wherever there's a business, that business person needs somebody to assist them with their financial statements, with their tax returns, and perhaps with some financial advice. The lifelong learning event is probably our most successful in terms of rural reach. Here again, remember, we are trying to tap into the employees that are currently employed at our employers. And as I've mentioned, there is literally an accountant in every small town. So we've traveled with Lifelong Learning up to Springbok. We've traveled to Upington. We've been to Clan William, Richards Bay, George, Queenstown, even Mthatha. So we managed to get that kind of training, which are really update seminars, right into the rural areas where our sector needs it. Higher education institutions, we work with all 23 of the universities, some to a larger or lesser extent. But what's very important is that the universities form the base of many of our qualifications, because a lot of our learners need a BCom or a BCom honors in order to get started in a learnership. So together with our professional bodies, we work with all of the higher education institutions. Our workplace providers, these are our accountants and our auditors, our accounting practices, our debt collectors practices, our management consulting organizations. And as I've mentioned, we literally find them in every small nook and cranny of the country. We're fortunate in that regard, because that means we can place learners at those practices very easily. The career guidance campaign, we really have received the best reach in terms of the nine provinces. We use various publications. We've been very interested to see there are very specialist provincial and educational publications that are reaching learners. For instance, there's a publication called Free for All, which reaches 300,000 learners across the country. The Careers Unlimited book reaches all learners in all nine provinces. And then we're also trying to explore the idea of mobile technology, where through the internet and cell phone technology, learners can really receive information and also tap into the internet in any kind of remote area. We're also exploring there the idea, a marketing term called brand ambassadors, where we actually place learners at universities, we recruit the actual students at a university, or at the University of Technology, and they become FACET brand ambassadors and skill development ambassadors. They're then able to talk to their colleagues about career choices in the FACET sector and also promote the use of learnerships in the FACET sector. What all this eventually means is that once we've managed to get people through these interventions via our quality assurance processes, we are definitely aware that this creates an environment where these learners, once they've qualified, have decent work. And by having decent work, this enables them to increase their earning capacity and eventually will lead to sustainable livelihoods. So the Robert Zwanis of this world don't only qualify, their increased earning capacity can allow them to support other dependents, their brothers and sisters. They also become role models in areas where previously there were no role models of that nature. So it's quite important that the Robert Zwanis of this world can become the first chartered accountant from an area like Umzimkulu or Giyani, because previously there may not have been those role models where a black person has moved into a chartered accounting or professional environment. So our learnerships for the 10 years, we've managed to register close to 40,000 learners. That means there are 40,000 people that are coming through the system that will eventually have professional qualifications leading to decent work and sustainable livelihoods. Already almost 20,000 of them have completed, and by completing we mean they've finished their articles, they may still be writing qualifying exams, and as Cheryl has indicated, over the years, they will slowly move up the ranks and into more junior and senior management positions in the accounting firms. What we also haven't noted is that 54 to 56% of our learners are also female. So at least we are getting something right with the gender. 100% of learners that complete our learnerships are employed, because it would hardly be likely that any accountant would be unemployed in the current economic situation. Not all of them are getting employed in the facet sector. Some of them are also employed, obviously, outside of the sector because they take up financial director positions in other companies. In terms of the lifelong learning, for this current year, based on our annual report, we've trained 13,500 people. That means 13,500 people that received updates and have got new information to work professionally with the work that they do. Over the 10 years, we've trained over 56,000 people in that way. One of the ways that we've managed to incorporate and use our interventions effectively is through the partnerships that we've created over the years. The first block is QAP, that's a new term. Those are our quality assurance partners. We do believe that we can't just churn out numbers and numbers of learners, but that the training of those learners needs to be of a specific standard and a particular quality. We therefore partner with professional bodies in the sector, like the Chartered Institute of Chartered Accountants, the Institute of Management Accountants, and so on. We partner with them to facilitate quality interventions in the sector. It also enables us not to waste resources and duplicate the work that they would be doing in that area. Our career guidance partners include people like Career Planet, who is actually stationed in Cape Town, the Graduate, who assists us to facilitate exhibitions at universities and universities of technology, and Student Village, who will assist us with the brand ambassadors. In terms of public higher education, we have a number of projects with various universities. I'll just name some examples. We work very closely with the University of Johannesburg on one of our development projects. We are currently working with the Walter Sisulu University to try and look at a specific stream of a BCom that leads to the ACCA qualification. We work closely with the University of Stellenbosch, who is trying to reschool previous grade 12 learners that haven't gained entrance into the university and give them additional maths and literacy to get them into the university and therefore enable them to pursue a career in finance. We also have a very new pilot project with the Eastern Cape Skills Council and the University of Fort Hare, where we are testing a dual university program. We're very fortunate in terms of the public sector. As Cheryl mentioned, we work very well with SARS. SARS often takes on our learners from development projects. National Treasury is involved with the learnerships. The Auditor General also has learners from our learnerships. And a very exciting project at the moment is that we're working with the municipalities, where we've managed to assist them via a specific local government finance learnership to train up 2,000 learners that will then look at the actual municipality finance skill shortages. In terms of the CETAs, we've managed across for cross-sectoral learners to train up to 2,000 learners either learners from other sectors, learners in our sector on other feeder learnerships, or learners from other sectors that have taken up our learnerships. We've got projects running with the wholesale and retail sector in terms of the accounting technician qualification. We have the municipality learnership with the local government CETA, and we also have a program with the MERS CETA around accounting technicians. Then last but not least, our professional bodies. We've managed to work with them in terms of Olympiads, where they've recruited up to 1,500 learners at schools and encouraged them to excel in accounting. We also partner with them around conferences, sponsoring their events, and also in terms of assisting with career guidance as they make their way through various universities.
Nadine, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
Madam Chair, I think it's also an obligation of PASIS to point out to the committee some of the challenges we face in the work that we do. And there are two different types of challenges that we face. The first type of challenge we've titled pipeline challenges, and that's the input of young people into our sector. And those challenges look at the poor matric results we're getting and the number of young people who come out with mathematics at a suitable level to be able to reach our sector is declining over time. We're also obviously impacted by the high dropout rate at tertiary institutions. So a lot of young people enter undergraduate study. We really look after the people when they come out of that undergraduate study, but we're losing a lot of young people in that process. The other important point that Nadine referred to in her presentation is that FACET is actually an incubator sector for the rest of the economy, because the majority of accountants in our country actually don't work in the FACET sector. They work in commerce and industry, they work in the public sector, but the majority of those people get trained in the FACET sector. So we're really an incubator sector for the rest of the economy, and the partners we have in our sector take that responsibility very seriously. So firms do train young people that they know at the end of the training are going to leave them. And we're very excited about the new catalytic grant process, which we see coming through in NSDS 3, because that's going to give us even more of an opportunity in the FACET sector to access funding to be able to train wider groups of people. Looking at the current year and some of the instability issues that we faced, obviously the move to the Department of Higher Education and Training was something that we've had to incorporate into our internal structures. It's working incredibly well, and we're seeing the benefits of education and training being under one department. So I think that's really going to exacerbate and escalate the kind of training that we do going forward. One of the other issues is the establishment of the QCTO, the Quality Council for Trades and Occupations, and how that's going to unfold and how we're going to map FACET's quality assurance model and partners into the new QCTO, because at all costs we've got to maintain international standards in the sector and the training that we do. And then obviously one of the very big unknowns is the finalization of NSDS 3 that we're still waiting for. And we need to be able to align our strategy and our research to what we need to do to continue our good interventions going forward. So, Madam Chair, in a nutshell, that's what FACET has been doing over the last year and some of the challenges that we faced into this year and going forward. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much for the presentation. Members, I'm going to open for comments, questions, so that we take. And in tight with the presentation, I'm noting Honourable Van der Veeseven, Honourable Mushwana, Honourable Lopez Lawrence, Honourable Gina, Honourable Nelson, Honourable Makubela, you'd be the last one. Honourable Khatib, you'd be the last one. In that order, members.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you for the presentation. Can I just ask? At the beginning, you said, and you actually boasted, that you were running a lean and mean organization. Well, ma'am, my impression is that the organization has been putting on a lot of fat in the last year, and that the increases in administrative expenses are not matched in terms of higher outputs. Your own remuneration has gone up by 21%, so has your COO's. your revenue has not really gone up. Your increase in employer grant and project expenses hasn't matched the 21% increase in income, etc. And we also know that last year has been a particularly difficult year for many of those people paying the levies. We can see it in your levy income. Now, there seems to me a disparity between the good life working for the CETA and the people that need to siphon off money from their profits to fund the CETA. So if you could just explain to me and tell me why or are my observations incorrect. Also, if I look at page 15 of your annual report, it also seems to me as if the mandatory grant applications dropped, and also the number of applications that were approved also dropped. Now, to me, it's actually sliding backwards, whereas one would think that more and more employers would be making use of the grants to train people, because that is eventually what we want. And then also, ma'am, lastly, if I could just ask, sometimes you were giving us annual figures, sometimes you were giving us figures for the last decade. Now, if I think of the learnerships, we are looking, it seems to me, at less than 200 learners achieving a learnership certificate for each of the last 10 years, which, if I look at the cost involved with those learnerships, seems to be exorbitantly expensive. Also, if we look at some of your interventions, it seems to me as if per annum less than 1,000 people benefited from that. And this from an organization that has got an income of 200 million rand. Something is just not telling me that we're achieving effectiveness, cost effectiveness in our training. And if you could please advise us as a committee as to how you see greater cost effectiveness being achieved in this sort of training. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I would like to thank Cherry for the report that we got. But I got a few questions to ask, starting with your gender representative at the management level. Because when I look at page 4 here, it's like you have 25% women at that particular level, but the representation that we see in front of us, it's giving something at 90%. Now I'm checking if, did you bring the management or you brought the middle staff to come and give us the report? Because it's different from what's on the paper. Like women are many here, but which positions are you filling? And the second question is your learnership. What informs your split into provinces? Because if it's about the numbers, I see Northern Cape do not have many people, but it's very close to Limpopo and Mpumalanga. In fact, that I don't know if it's informed by the population or something else informs your employment. And on your partnership, you say you partner with municipalities, but is it in all provinces, or are you talking of municipalities in Gauteng only? Because your career guidance is like in Cape Town. And why would you be concentrating on Cape Town only if you are supposed to assist the whole country? Because we rely on your company to do this. And your future skills development, you say the input of young people is not relevant, but I do not see any time frames to change this. Because if you have a concern, it's good that you need more input from the young folks. But do you have any time frames as to how you plan to change this particular situation? Thank you.
Yes, only two short questions, or actually one. It's on page 4 and page 5, the middle slide on page 4. And the learnerships, my colleague has partly already covered what I was going to ask, but
have a look at the 4,278 learners signed onto learnerships and then 3,367 completed. Over a period of time, will you please explain to us, it's actually very vague to understand that slide properly. And then the following page, on page 5, the bottom slide, registered 39,000, completed 19,000 over a period of 10 years. What is the dropout rate? It seems to be 66%. Will you please explain? It doesn't look, determine exactly what's going on there. Thank you.
Chairperson, thank you. My first question, Chair, will be on the positions that they are here. When looking at the annual report, maybe we need an explanation. I'm a little bit confused. Looking at the annual report, we've got another chairman. When it comes to, when they come here, the way they've introduced themselves, there is that thing that I don't understand. So if ever they can explain that to us, to me, because I'm a little bit confused around that issue. Secondly, Chairperson, I was also going to talk on the issue of salaries, looking at the huge gap that is there. But I think I was partly covered by the first speaker who has just asked the question. But I think the gap is too huge between the top management and the people that are working there. If ever we can get just a picture of what is happening, even those huge increments that you see there, I think they are raising a concern. Chairperson, I'm very happy to hear the story of Eric, of Robert, yes. But again, I'm a little bit concerned, Chairperson, the way the story is being told to us. Yes, it's good. Yes, we agree. We want to see black people climbing the ladders as we are hearing. But I would like to caution again and to say the way you put it, it should not be as if it's when it was presented, it's as to say it was a great thing that you can see a black person getting up to that standard. It's as if when you look at a black person, you cannot expect him or her to climb up that ladder that much. So whenever he has done that, the way it is put, I'm just wanting to say, yes, we agree, it has been a good thing, but let us not then label it as if it was one of the things that was done by Robert, one of the things that was done by a black person, as if we cannot afford to do that. Yes, but yes, thank you very much for the sister that he has done that, but really, let us not exaggerate when we talk of this, as if it was the thing that just out of this world for a black person to get into that position. And lastly, Chairperson, this one has been mentioned too, because it has been my concern. If ever really we can get a breakdown as to say, this is the annual report, what have we done in this annual report, what have we done during this year, because most of the things we are confused, we don't know, we're looking back at 10 years ago, we don't know really. For me, when I go out here, I cannot say what is the city, what the city has done in the year that they came here to present on. Please can clarify on that one. Thank you.
Honorable Nelson.
Thanks, Chair. Mine is going to go around the challenges that are being experienced. We know that we've got extremely high dropout rates of students at universities. What is CETA, or do you have a program to deal with that? We know in other instances you've organizations, CETAs, and we'd like to see CETAs doing this, putting mentorship programs into place, because I think we're all aware students are struggling, maths and science is a problem, and that is the cause of our kids dropping out of university. So is there a strategy in place to address this dropout rate? Is there a strategy in place, because you are in the finance, I mean, you are in the accounting field. Is there, or in the maths field, have you identified this as a gap? So let us do something, let us put a strategy into place to address this, this maths crisis, this science crisis that we have with our young people. And also then mentor that they can, maybe we can push them through. The second one, Chairperson, is on targets and achievements. How your targets determined? In some instances, the targets are far exceeded. Is that not that it's a good thing? It is a good thing, but are the targets then not set at too low a level? And that's why you have this, you know, over 200% reaching of that target. So how does target set and how do you intend setting them in future? Thanks, Jay.
Thank you, Honorable Nelson. Honorable Makubela.
Chairperson, thanks. I think I'll try and avoid the questions up already, although one or two may need emphasis. In this particular setup, all of them, are about redressing the evils of the past and transformation. Now, are you able to talk to a transformation kind of a program that clarifies whoever you meet, this is what is being done? You're changing the situation in this particular way. You mentioned the challenges, you're mentioning other things and so on. But it's like that acceptable to you that probably there will be these difficulties and so on and so on. And when you come across the student who are struggling in this particular profession, most of them are not struggling academically. They will cite other issues which are barriers to their achievement. Very clear. They'll tell you about how it is so difficult for them to qualify. In fact, they say it's made difficult for them to qualify. Not that they could not qualify themselves. Because it can't be that it's only Robert Zwane who can perform extremely well out of millions of black people. It can't necessarily happen like that. And quite a lot of those who have tried 2 or 3 years to try and achieve or qualify, they've not done so. For an example, some will tell you that in some of these firms, when they're doing their articles, they are restricted to a particular language which causes them or causes them to be unable to qualify. Some will insist on Afrikaans and so on, as they do that. To what extent do you know about this issue? Because you are on the field. You're responsible there. You must talk in greater detail or in depth in terms of what the challenges are, which causes a problem to their achievement. Because the potential exists, but we're looking at the other barriers which must be removed for them to be able to qualify. And we can't just talk finances and many other things. Because finance is one part, and I think an emphasis on that has been made. But there must be issues that are made by men to cause another man to have difficulties, you know, and I think we must be able to talk to those issues and tackle. You talked about the training that the employer institutions are doing well and so on, and they give you the plans and so on and so on. But what comes first? Is it employer organizations that know what the training needs are, as if the sitter does not know what to expect or what should happen? Or the sitter must have its own input as well to saying what this employer organization should do. In as much as they fund that program, in as much as they know what they need, but you must have your own input. And who should influence who in the process? That brings me to the issue of the board's functionality. It's a pity that the board chairperson, whoever is the actual chairperson, but the board chairperson as in this meeting today, did not go at length in terms of explaining, accounting to the team, to us here, what their level of or their actual role is and whether it's being successful and all. Because in as much as the CEO has to explain everything, we are also more interested in what the board itself drives the ship. Whether that talks to the transformation agenda that established you. That's what it will be able to come from the board chapter on behalf of the other board members to saying we are established, this is our mandate. Because that mandate is not just sure academic or curriculum kind of, it's to a greater extent talking to the political agenda of the country. So the board is established on that basis, and that should be the accounting level of the board. The CEO will talk to the how finances were utilized and so on and so on, rightly or wrongly, whether they achieved a clean audit or whatever. That's fine. But that clean audit does not tell us really about what we need to understand as a country, whether we're going for the right direction or not. So the functionality of the board, the involvement of the union should be talked whether the board is well functional or not. You talked the quality assurance kind of structure, which partnered with you to the programs that you provide. Whether that was approved by government or
whatever. Honorable Makubela, your phone must move away from that, or anyone who's sitting next to you. Whoever is sitting next to you, can we all make sure the phone is off? Very difficult.
Or even 10 years that people will have spent pursuing this program may not be useful. Chair, for now, thanks.
Thank you, Honorable Khatem.
Thank you, Chair. I thought you were going to give Honorable Makubela last because, you know, he takes too long, you know. So, this is a very appreciated report that you are bringing to the committee, except, you know, some few challenges there and there. But also in terms of your marketing communication strategy, I would also recommend that you also make use of the municipalities in order to ensure that you reach one of these districts. Because using newspapers, radio, may not be enough. But the municipalities are the nearest to the destitute. So that's my recommendation. Okay. I'm trying to avoid it, but it really needs to get a clarity. It's an emphasis from my side. Because, you know, when the unions start doing and make noise. They make noise about salaries, salary gaps. They speak about issues that people on the ground, they don't get anything. People at the top, they get, you know, double bonus and all that stuff. I'm just looking at your report, né? Page 27. You know, the salary scale there, somewhere it's by two. You know, I'm trying to look at the ratio that you used in, you know, your increment in terms of your salaries. That is from where to where, because, yeah, my understanding is that, you know, you are, you know, salaries, others are from, you know, 300 to 600. That's double the amount, and you tend to question yourself to say whether there was any formula used for adjusting this salary. Because according to my understanding is that there's a formula that is used in order to adjust salaries. That's why this percentage, 5%, 0.1 or 1% or someone, so that you can be able to understand. Because you don't want, at the end of the day, also, you fall into the trap whereby people complain, or your staff, they start to making noise about issues of salary. We should avoid such kind of situation. But also in terms of your race and gender, of your slide 4, the race and gender part there, it doesn't really give me much confidence. You see, when you're going to see in the top management, see 19% from the blacks, from the whites, you see 35%. I'm trying to get an understanding or, you know, a base to say what is the challenge? Why can't at least the ratio goes a little bit, you know, balanced? But also what I want to understand, your issue of clarifying blacks, because I heard you when you explaining the issue of Robert, say one of the black students, Robert. So I was getting clarity when you say black, because black, you know, includes also Chinese. So you must be able to give me a proper clarity so that I can understand, because you might say this addresses the previous disadvantaged students, whereas you found out that it's skewed. That's one, some of the things that I needed to understand. It was also in terms of your intervention in slide 6, there in terms of your learnership, you said you've got 52% black learners that, you know, been placed. But, you know, another thing that you must able to understand, the issue of gender. It's very much imperative for us to understand as we address the issue of women empowerment. Because when we say 52%, you might find that 42% are male. It doesn't assist. it really doesn't address what they want to address. Lastly, maybe I think Honorable Makubela has just questioned that the issue of your partnership, because I need to get a clarity in terms of how do you manage to compose the issue of your partnerships, because I needed also to get a clarity clearly in the public sector. What exactly did you mean by public sector? Because, you know, your partnership must be able to draw in even also the ones that, you know, you've got interest. Young people that are organized themselves, you know, to form partnerships so that they can be able to assist in ensuring that they fit with all relevant information. So, but I needed to just to get a clarity in terms of that, what in terms of your formation of your, the scope of your partnership, how did you come, you know, within that aspect? But, Chair, I guess those are some of my questions. Yes, Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Khadebe, and thanks, members, for your input. I think the major challenge that we're sitting with here is that NSD has two targets, which are very, very low. That's why you can have about 200 achievements or above. We've seen this consistent thing about across the city. And I think from the department, it's very imperative when we set NSD as three targets that we really note this issue. If we set low targets, they come as achievements, all of them. But are we really achieving what we want to achieve? Transformational agenda, being able to have the inputs that we want to have? We're not. The money that is sitting there being spent, it's not translating to what we want to see. So the question and the major issue where we are sitting, I think the NSDS targets need to really drastically improve and move from where they are sitting. We can't sit with all the sitters anymore. That, because if you once have a target that is achieved more than 300%, it says to you have set very, very, very low targets across the demand, because it speaks to the demand. There's high demand, but you're sitting very low targets. So as part of issues of performance, I think that this is one of the critical issues that must be dealt with. But again, you see, I'm looking at FACET annual report. It's good. It's very, very summarized, I must say. You don't get details of issues. On your presentation, you sort of highlighted about issues of disability. Nowhere in the report I pick up anything on disability. What are the sectors achieving any targets in terms of training the disabled sector? Where are we sitting in terms of targets there, the percentage-wise? Where is it? Because I'm expecting that when you look at the document, it must give us details of what we're looking for. It must speak to the issues that we must be able to see. So if an annual report is summarized, and when you talk about the issues of performance, noting that you're talking about NSDS 2 reporting, it covers only 3 pages of this annual report. And just explain to us what you mean when you say a deficit in CETA is good. Maybe I might have a different understanding. Just give us that understanding so that we are able to engage from the point of us as the portfolio committee. But the other thing that I want you to tell us, your tracking of learnership. Somewhere in your finances, you are highlighting expenditure on that. I try to pick up what you mean by tracking. Where do you track them? Where are they? What? How do you track them, these learners? But, sorry? Yeah, but the other thing, you are quiet on RPL. Silent, completely silent. You are silent on the issue of skills layoff. Have you experienced anything? You had the mandate today. You are very silent on it as well. Nothing at all. You are silent on new venture creations. That's something, your report is very, very summarized. But I'm not so sure what we're doing. We really, yeah. But again, the link with FET, besides career guidance, what is the link there? What is it that you are doing with FETs? Is there any work that you're doing with FETs specifically? So that we understand, it can be, I just saw the career guidance on FETs, 1,000 I think, of career guidance. But what is the link beyond career guidance? Because I don't think that should be limited to that. Last thing, okay, two last things quickly, so that I allow you to give us some response so that we can engage. The issue of lifelong learnership. What are this? What just explain to me, what are they being trained of? I see it's your major learnership where you are absorbing a lot of people. So because we're talking about transformation of the sector. As we're sitting here, this sector is one of the sectors that is not even transformed to the level that you want. There's challenges even on CAs, there's a lot of challenges around this. But if you are to talk where I just want to see the learnership that are entering, are they speaking to the demand that is there in the country? The other thing that I'm a bit concerned of, your audit committee members, for example, you are reporting that each city of the meeting, they are paid 5,000 per city. Mr. Hoon, I'm coming back to you. This I'm going to labor until the end. This disparities. Other cities, there's zero paid to members, board members. Others is extremely high. Others is failing. You have another one not paying zero, it's zero. Another one is paying 300. The other one is paying 5,000. I mean, really. This is one sector. It's skills, it's CTAS, all of them. Belonging to South Africa, all of them. What is it that really determines this amount? Isn't some of this amount needed to be placed in a right direction somewhere? 5,000, quite honestly, is too high. For a board meeting, it's extremely high. I'm not so sure how we came to that amount. 5,000 per sitting. No, really. I'm just saying this is something that I said that the department would have to look at. We can't have this extreme. But again, the issue, it goes, I think Honorable Makubela has spoke about the issue of transformation that goes into the sector. And maybe I will allow you to respond so that when we come to that, we are able to speak to it. And noting that you have received a clean audit, we appreciate that. I always say that we are happy not to worry about financial mismanagement and have to focus on the performance issues and the output that you are able to produce. Because more than anything, beyond the finances as well, we're expecting output, we're expecting performance, we're expecting the impact that you do into the country. So as much as this committee has a view that it's not important that much, we appreciate it, but our focus is on performance to be able to see the translation of the money being spent. You see, the fact that as a country we are spending so much money on education, I know you are reflecting that in terms of what Minister Pravin Gordhan has said, it's true. But does that translate to the output for us to be able to say the money spent in education, because you are part of the education sector, the money spent in you with the teachers, the allocations, the levies coming from employers, are we really, really getting the output that we want? And from where I'm sitting, I'm saying, no, we've not reached that point. And the question is, what are the issues? What are the challenges? Why are we not having the money translating into the output? Why are we not having the percentage that we are spending from GDP and from our budget translating to what we want to see? Because South Africa will become a better place, transformed, economy growing, when we have skilled individuals in this country being able to be economically active. So we'll see that economic growth. But unless we are able to have a change and a shift, and I'm hoping that the city also will start thinking with the landscape and all that, but have a new thinking of we've done. You've had 10 years of this achievement that you're talking about. But how do we translate and start doing things differently? Because routine sometimes does not assist. But how do we get to the point that we do things differently, to the point that they assist? If we are sitting and we're saying our view as a seeker is to contribute to this portion, and it's not translating to what we want to see South Africa, because all of us are role players in this country to make South Africa a better place for all of us, including those who are not active in the economy. But to say, how do we start now translating that and saying, let's move from gear 4 to gear 5, or from gear 5 to gear 6, to fast-tracking the impact that we want to see at this country? I think those are the issues. And I think from the board, the issues of transformation, that's why we give you an opportunity to first give us a highlight. Because we expect that the board should give us direction in where this ship is going. But it's face exit. The board must be able to say to us, I think there were questions even around remuneration, which I'm expecting the board to explain to us, that if we're sitting with a challenge of economic crisis and you have 21%, I mean, maybe let me just, and then I'll come back to the issues, but just explain to us and respond to the issues that have been raised by members. And I'll start again with the board chairperson as the leader of the delegation.
My name is Ms. Chairperson and members. An explanation from our side in terms of Robert being the chairperson and I being the vice chairperson, while in the annual report I am the chairperson. You will note that the report is until a period, and that is a period which I was the chairperson, and at the moment, the current period, Robert is the chairperson. So that is the explanation why he is the chairperson, and we happen to change roles, that I am now the vice chairperson and he's the chairperson. Okay. And an explanation on the governance issues to add on what Robert mentioned earlier to the committee. As a board, we have a main board, management board. And may I mention at this stage, Madam Chairperson, our board is working on a voluntary basis. We don't get paid for the work that we do for FASIC. It is only the audit committee that gets paid. And it is for specific reasons, because not that the audit committee members are more professional than the other board members, but it's because of the nature of the work that they do and the value that they bring to the board, and we have specifically taken the decision. We don't want to be paid, but we will pay the people to get them to come and do the work.
I think 5,000 is justified for those audit committees.
Madam, it is definitely justified, and if I work for a private sector, and I can tell you where I sit on other boards of other companies, 5,000 is nothing.
That's a crisis in this country.
So
it's a general crisis in this country of board payments, quite honestly.
I think I understand, and I take note of that. But I would like to believe there are instances where it probably is an issue of mismanagement, but it's not all cases where it is. Otherwise, the organizations would not get the skills and the time that is required, because until you sit on the board and understand the time that one has to give in preparation and in actual attendance of the meeting, and you still have your day job and have to do and carry on with all that. That is the pressure that we are facing, and I'm not justifying, but it is a fact that we are facing, yes, in the country. With regard to
the issue is not that we don't want them to be paid. I'm saying, because we've had other sitters who has audit committees. We've had other companies who has audit committees, and is the highest paying as a sit. That's why I'm questioning in that regard.
Madam Chair, I think I'm going to not deliberate on the issue because we, as a board, as well, consider that along with the guidelines that we have from the existing statutory publications. So I will leave because that becomes much more operational, where I would depend on management to give more detail. But I am sure and I'm comfortable as a board, when we were presented with those fees, we considered them and we felt comfortable with that. The board has got a few committees that we use for governance, because as a board we do meet as a complete board, but we have an executive committee in place, and the executive committee has got certain mandates that they would look after for the board, on behalf of the board, but the board is finally accountable for the decisions that the executive committee would take on our behalf. We also have the audit committee, as we have also mentioned. We have the finance committee, FinCo, which considers the finances on the board's behalf, and again, we have very strong skills sitting there. And when they present back to the board would engage robustly in questioning any decisions that would have been taken. We also have REMCO. REMCO looks at the issues of salaries, as have already been highlighted. And we, as and when we need, we do benchmarking. Last year was not so easy for us to do benchmarking of salaries with other CETAs, because that's what we use, because the information is also publicly available. And we believe that the decisions that we have taken in the increases or the adjustments of the salaries for our management team are justified. If we pulled out the minutes for those meetings, we would still be able to say, yes, they may look to have been very high or too high, but we comfortable as a board that they were justified.
You're saying what was the reason? Okay, you can't be answering on your own salary. That doesn't make sense.
Madam Chair, I think I understand your ruling that she can't be answering on that, but we're sitting here, we didn't bring that kind of detailed information, and as I'm saying, as a board, while we would be making the decisions, we would be delegating to management to do the work, because it's operational for them to do the research and come back to us.
So what do you mean that it was originated from the management who decided that they would get a 21 increase and then they sent it to the board?
No.
The board looked. I'm trying to understand what you're saying.
Okay. I'm going to ask Robert, because okay. He was a member of the REMCO last year while I was management chairperson.
Okay. Madam Chair, ladies and gentlemen, what we do is this. Each employee in our CETA has set certain objectives that they have to achieve. They are rated on their achievement of those objectives. If they get 100% of their objectives, they get a certain percentage salary increase. They do not achieve as much, they get less, and so on. It's a standard format used for setting salaries throughout South Africa, and it's quite common. This is a process that we used in REMCO to assess salaries. Once we've done that, we do it on an individual person's basis, and each person's salary is reviewed, and we arrive at a particular figure. We then compare that to the benchmark we have with other CETAs, such as that information is available. And we make sure that we're paying within certain parameters. There is a tendency, we agree, that we pay people in our CETA maybe a little bit more than the average in other CETAs. But quite frankly, you get what you pay for. We have got a superb bunch of people who work for us. We run on, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, Cheryl, 22 people? Now, for a CETA of our size, to run with 22 people is pretty good. Many other CETAs of similar or slightly larger sizes than us have got more people. You get what you pay for. And we've got staff retention. People do not go. They all work incredibly hard, and they achieve their objectives. And quite frankly, we have no problem in doing that, Madam Chair. Because we believe that in paying what we pay, that is one of the reasons why we attract the best, and we believe we are one of the best administered CETAs. The fact that we haven't had those audit qualifications other people have is maybe just one example of that. There are plenty of others. And we feel quite satisfied with our salaries. Believe me.
Mr. Kappa, we're not questioning the capacity of the individuals. And you see, we are saying, we wanted to understand why you came to the determination of 21% increase. That's what. And we are saying, I think the question that was coming through from the member was in your sector, based on what you are reporting to us, reflected difficulties because of the economic issues that they were faced with. The challenges of the economy at your sector, people who are contributing towards your running of the city, are facing difficulties financially. How do you justify 21% increase? That's the issue. Couldn't you have at least acknowledging that the people are doing good? 10% could have been even still good. What made you to go to the level of 21%? I'm still not convinced from where I'm sitting. There are a lot of other sitters who have got good, no clean audit. They've got clean audit. They've got good management retention strategies. They've got that they don't have 21% increase if you are basing it on other sitters. You're not the only one. But we want to understand. I think that's the issue. And you're not answering our questions, quite honestly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Let me provide the clarity there. You would recall that with the changes that happened in government and the city's uncertainty, not knowing if the cities are going to be relicensed or what is really going to be happening in the coming year, what we decided as a board, because we wanted to retain the talent that we had, we decided to put in place retention bonuses. And the 21% is not necessarily an increase of the salary component, but it is an amount that we paid for to management for retention purposes. So it's not completely 21%. Our increase was 10%. The salary increase.
So the 11% is the retention bonus.
The amount, yes, is really related to retention bonus. My apologies that we didn't understand. We didn't come out clearly on that aspect. So it's not necessarily the increase in salary. So when you see our figures next year, it will not be this whole amount. This was the once-off that we decided for retention bonuses.
Applies to all staff members.
It applies to all staff members.
21% to all staff members.
Madam Chair, the rate of bonus varies depending on the length of service of the staff. It averaged out at about 9 or 10%. So when you're looking at an increase in salary of 20%, 9 or 10% of that was of the once-off bonus. And the annual increment based on performance achievements is the balancing 10%. So what I'm saying is if you compare the figures now with next year's, you're probably going to see very little change because the bonus will have fallen away. So the basic salary plus whatever increment is appropriate based on our policies that we've approved will probably equate to more or less the same figure now, including the bonus.
Just one follow-up on that one. Even your office assistant was paid a retention bonus.
Yep, everybody. Depending on the amount was based on the length of service. And if the office assistant has been in the firm, I think Anna's been there probably about 8 or 9 years by now, she received an appropriate bonus based on her salary scale, based on 8 or 9 years existing service.
Madam Chair, I think I have covered it. If there's any area that maybe I omitted, could you
issue of transformation from the point of the board? Asked by Honourable Makubele.
Transformation from the point of the board, I'm not sure I understand the question. Is it transformation of the sector or transformation of the board?
Honourable Makubele, just specifically to the board issue.
You are established to deal with the issues of skilling, but broadly, there are issues within the sector that talk to transformation. For instance, you needed to improve in terms of the uptake of previously disadvantaged persons, persons with disabilities, gender issues, and all that. You're not talking to those clerks, how you're achieving them, and what are your targets to dealing with that. You're talking 52%, for instance, in terms of previously for black people. without necessarily saying Indian, colored, and African. But over 10 years, was that your target that by this 10 years...
Honorable Makuben, why every time you're speaking there's something happening next to you?
We must investigate, Chair, I think. But, yes, I think my question is clear, Chair. We're not necessarily talking about the board wanted to understand its functionality, you know, whether it's capable of handling these issues as required or expected of them.
Madam Chair, if I may, I'll deal with most of that. I'd like to break the area of transformation into two areas, because one is easier to deal with than the other. I'm going to hive off for the moment the problem of disadvantage, which is a different area. And look first at the gender and cultural issues. There are two ways in which I'd like to answer your problem. Firstly, you must remember that in order to get a qualification in our sector, it takes a long time. It takes on average 7 years. Because you've got a four-year university training, and once you've done that, you've then got a three-year learnership period within the profession itself, if I'm looking at my own sector, which is the Chartered Accountants one. Okay. Now, we've got to get people through that, so we've got to compare our figures with what they were 7 years ago. Now, 7 years ago, they were hideous. I don't have the statistics. I'm not going to talk statistics. But we started recruiting and encouraging that sort of thing from 7 years ago. Only now are those people working through the top of the 7 years and coming out of the sausage machine at the end, and therefore only now are statistics, both culturally and gender-wise, gradually changing. Each year from now on, you'll see steady change. But in the past, it's been very slow because the people within the sausage machine over these last 7 years have probably been predominantly people like me, white males. Can't help it, that's the way it takes. The second thing is, when it comes to actually trying to promote gender and cultural equality, many of our grants or things we do are specifically aimed at our, should we say, the black market, whether you use the definition of purely black or whether you include Indian and colored in that definition as well. Doesn't matter. For example, our discretionary grants that we pay, white people are eliminated. We don't use those as a criteria. So that is the other way in which we're trying to change the profile of our sector. Okay. It will take time, but it will enhance now that the sausage machine is 7 years old. Now the sausages coming out of the machine are far more likely to be of the previously disadvantaged kind and will therefore satisfy your needs. That's that one issue. That's the gender and the cultural issue. The other lesser, but nonetheless very important criteria of those who are disabled. Again, I speak under pressure. I think the desired percentage is 4% in any organization. But the trouble is that many people in our sector need to be very mobile. And they need to have all the wits about them. And we find not that we don't want to have them. We definitely like to have them. But it's not a sector they choose to be employed in. It's an issue. We're very aware of this, and we're trying all sorts of things we can do to try and raise it. It is an issue we're very aware of, and that is not affected by the sausage machine. It's something we have to deal with. We're aware of the criticism, and we accept it, and we're doing our best to do what we can about it. But unless there are any specific initiatives on the go that I'm not aware of, there I will have to look at Cheryl, but that's not operational. Cheryl, can you amplify what I'm saying on this issue, or have I dropped you in it?
Chair, if you'll allow me to comment on that, I think what we do is included in all of our development projects, which Nadine referred to, we do have a target that 4% of the learners on those graduate development projects need to be learners with disabilities. And in areas where we can, we do assist disabled learners to go through those work readiness programs. So we've assisted a number of blind learners. We've put braille facilities into those work readiness programs. We have a lot of learners with physical disabilities who are able to enter our sector. But when it comes to specific professional routes, and if I'm going to use the example of the chartered accountant route, if we're funding young people at a postgraduate level, because that's the level FACET funds at, we're reliant on there being undergraduate learners with disabilities available to take up those opportunities. And in a lot of instances, the pre-funding that FACET gets involved in, those young people are not available. So where we can, and just to give an example, Hussein, our deputy chair, has got a blind learner who came through one of the projects at FACET, who heads up one of the funds at the Stock Exchange. So when we take disabled learners onto the interventions, we assist them to go all the way in the profession.
Can I just follow up on that one? Ma'am, when we're looking at the distribution, the regional distribution, you said many of the call centers that do debt collection, or debt collection is very much a call center thing. Now, to my mind, the call center doesn't need a lot of mobility from the people working there. So I'm picking up a little bit of double speak here, in the sense that you're not really training chartered accountants that need to get on aeroplanes, and even a person in a wheelchair can get on an aeroplane nowadays. But that if you say, well, on the one hand, we can't expand regionally because we've got a lot of call centers in our sector. On the other hand, I say, but call centers are, yes, one of those fields which particularly lend itself to disabled people. So something somewhere I'm not getting. Thank you.
If I can try and respond to that, maybe one of the misunderstandings we've got between the FACET model and a number of the other CETAS models, and this might be leading to the confusion, is that FACET took a decision from year two that we do not fund all learners on learnership. Most CETAs fund all learners on learnerships. FACET only funds black and disabled learners. The majority of learners in our sector are still white, but they are not funded. And all we can take responsibility for is the change that we're affecting in the learners that we fund. So if you look at learners who are working at a call center in the debt collecting environment, the white learners who are part of that process, we are not supporting at all. When we fund the disabled learners, yes, we say we make funding available for disabled learners, but if that employer decides to still take on white learners outside of the spirit of what the CETA is trying to do, and they are able-bodied learners, there's nothing we can do about impacting on that. And that's why we end up, and it speaks, sir, to your question as well, in terms of transformation in the sector. FACET fund a minority of learners in our sector because we've obviously got a financial constraint. So you saw our learnership cash grant. We fund just under 800 learners. We've probably got 15,000 learners in the sector in any one year. And we can do nothing about the balance and the profile of those 14,000 learners that we don't fund.
Sorry, allow them to respond because I'm looking at time. We've got the AG's office to still. If you can proceed and answer other questions.
Chair, I'm going to try and respond to the questions. We've tried to group some of them together, so hopefully we'll cover all of the members' issues. If we do leave anything out, if you could please just raise it again. The question with regard to the decrease in the mandatory grant application forms, I think that is something we see fluctuate from year to year within the FACET sector. Two of the reasons why is that, as we said in the introduction, the majority of the FACET sector is SMME and very, very small employers. So we see large numbers of our employers moving in and out of that 500,000 cut-off threshold from one year to the next. And last year, with the economic recession, a lot more of our previous levy-paying members would fall below that threshold, and then they would come back in again. So that's one of the areas. We also see that a lot of very, very small firms choose not to participate in the mandatory grant process, but they might be participating in the lifelong learning and some of the other interventions that FACET offer. With regard to completion rates on learnerships per year, I think Robert also referred to that. I think it's important to note that the average learner on a FACET intervention is there for 7 to 10 years.
So what we're seeing, and Robert referred to it in his introductory remarks, is a lot of learners who came onto the learnership in 2002 are only coming out now. So the dropout rate is definitely not 60%. It's just a timing issue in terms of the length of time that it takes those learners to come out the process. And those learners are still registered as learners with FACET, so they're definitely not dropping out. We have a very low dropout rate in the learnership process at FACET. The cost effectiveness per year of the intervention, it's also very difficult to look at the figures that we've given you and to say the cost per intervention is very high. What FACET does on things like our learnership cash grant is we only fund the learner at this point in time on entry to the learnership. So the learner gets 27,000 Rand on the year that they enter the learnership, and that money goes to the employer to facilitate setup costs. During year two and year three of the learnership, that employer gets no assistance from FACET. So even though we are funding the entry in year one, you've actually got to split that cost over 3 years because that's the duration it would take the learner to qualify. What we're also seeing is that the cost of interventions, and it speaks to a question the gentleman raised over there earlier on, the cost of interventions in a professional sector are expensive. And we've seen from research that if you fund a young person on a bursary only and you just pay for the universities and fees and nothing else, the chances are that young person is going to drop out. They're hungry, they've got no transport costs, et cetera, et cetera. And FACET took a decision 4 or 5 years ago that we would fund fewer learners with more amount of money to make sure that our success rate is higher. So, for example, on a what we call a small practitioners project where we are funding black learners who are doing their CTA part-time through UNISA and completing articles at the same time, we go right down to funding that learner getting a driver's license. Because without a driver's license, that young person can't go and see clients, and they're not going to have a job. So yes, the costs are slightly higher, but it gives us a better return on investment. Gender representation in management, ma'am, to answer that, the FACET staff, the FACET full-time management team, are all women. And that is no conscious decision. We don't have a policy of only employing women in FACET. I think it's the nature of the job. It's the nature of the work we do. And if we look at FACET as an employer and we compare it to the professional bodies in our sector, you'll see the majority of people who work in professional bodies are also women. And I think it's the nature of the work we do. If we look at the profile of the sector, we have a huge gender problem at senior management level. There's absolutely no doubt about that. We have various interventions where we're trying to address it. We said earlier on that our grants are only available to black people. Our strategic cash grant is also available to white women who are studying at senior level. What we find is a lot of women who qualify in the sector, because it's a very pressurized sector, tend to leave the sector. So they would do their training at a professional firm and then they would go and work in commerce and industry. A lot of women also choose to take time out and to leave the profession on a full-time basis and to start up their own part-time practice. So instead of becoming a partner in a firm, you would be running a small accounting practice from home. So it's slightly different. We are aware of it. We try and address it and do as much as we can, but we don't know the answers to getting through that glass ceiling. Employment opportunities in provinces, we do know that the majority of our employers of young people are in the big cities. It's the nature of the sector, our stockbroking constituency, our management consulting constituency, are based predominantly in Gauteng and predominantly in Johannesburg. But as Nadine mentioned, there are employment opportunities in every small town. And what we are seeing is a lot of the accountants in those more rural areas are using facets, grants, and vehicles as an opportunity to start growing their practices. So where it was really just the accountant and maybe one assistant before, we're now starting to see that they will give one or two learners an opportunity to get their training within that environment as well.
You have one head office, you don't have regional offices?
We only have one head office as a secretariat based in Johannesburg. And as Robert indicated, we only employ 22 staff. So we work very, very strongly on a partnership model. Our professional bodies and organizations like ABASA, the Association for the Advancement of Black Accountants, have very big reach, and we tap into their reach rather than having infrastructure which makes our admin costs so much higher. The local government project that we're running is a pilot project that started down in the Eastern Cape, and it's currently running in the Eastern Cape and KwaZulu-Natal. So it's a rural-based project. It's not running in any urban centres. As that project is taking traction, what we're finding is more and more municipal areas are wanting to get involved in the project as well, and the project is starting to expand. Thank you very much for the advice of using municipalities for career guidance. I think that's definitely something we will take up. The time frames with regard to changing the management profile of race and gender in our sector, it is not something that the CETA has set specific targets against, but it is something that we would track both through the financial sector charter and through the chartered accountants draft charter. So there are specific sector charters that have been set up to look at transformation changes within this particular environment. And we tend to link our funding opportunities to those charters and their changes. I think, ma'am, I think I answered your question with regard to the learners in and learners out and the seven-year lead time that's looking like underachievement, but it's really just a timing issue. Thank you also for the advice in future when we present to you to focus on the current year statistics only. We will take that heed of that as well. The question with regard to how we assist learners who drop out of university to continue in that process, it's not something that FACET is directly involved in at this point in time. And the reason why is probably a conscious decision that FACET has taken. We've developed something called the Learning Pipeline for young people who want to enter the sector. And the Learning Pipeline really starts at school level where people might make incorrect choices by not taking the correct maths, et cetera, et cetera, all the way to the postgraduate and professional level when people qualify in the FACET sector. And we're not able, due to limited resources predominantly, to support the whole pipeline. The problem is just much bigger than FACET is. So we tend to concentrate on those learners that we can give opportunities to get out the other end as quickly as possible. And as Nadine says, our main focus is dealing with the unemployed graduates when they come out the system, because there's even more unemployed graduates than we can deal with, and we really just haven't got the resources to get involved in undergraduate level. A lot of our professional bodies, however, and a lot of the firms who offer bursaries to young people during that course of study do have very strong mentor programs and support programs for young people undergoing full-time university study. The question with regard to how our targets are set, we go through quite a rigorous process at FACET. The start of our target-setting process, Madam Chair, is what's in contained in NSDS 2, so we would be using the national strategy as our starting point. And then what we do is we look at our research, we look at the funding that we have available, and we see how much we could legitimately contribute to that national target based on the amount of funding we have available in any year and the interventions that we have in place in a year that can speak to those targets. So we definitely do use that as a departure point. The question from the gentleman with regard to do we use the WSP as the starting point or do we use some other kind of research as a starting point for facet interventions, the answer to that is that we actually use both. We do sector ground research in the facet sector, which results in our sector skills plan, which is a five-year document based on the research of training needs within the broader sector. Each year, the employer obviously does their own workplace skills plan to see what their specific business needs are based on their business strategy. We analyze those workplace skills plans every year to make sure we feed the employer's needs into our research for the new year. Where we do make use of facets research only, which I think is very important, is when we make funding decisions outside of the mandatory funding. The mandatory funding facet has got no option. If somebody gives us a mandatory grant, a workplace skills plan, we have to pay the mandatory grant, even if they're not training in scarce and critical skills areas. And that's not our discretion, that's the law. The discretionary funding we only gear towards what facet sees as being important. I think some of the questions have been answered by both Singh and Robert. With your permission, I'm going to leave the quality assurance partner model and Nadine can answer those questions once we've finished. Also regard to the question the gentleman had with regard to 100 FET colleges. Included in those 100 are colleges, private colleges that operate in the facet sector. People like Boston City Campus who are operating at that level, and they have a number of satellite campuses. So our reference to FET colleges are not only public sector FET colleges, but they also provide private providers operating at that level. The question with regard to unaccredited universities and young people who might have to spend an extended time because they choose the wrong university to go to. I think it's very important that FACET is not a CETA that supports one professional body only. So somebody like SAICA might have accredited universities and unaccredited universities, but those young people would have the options to go to other professional bodies that are just as well known in the sector, organizations like CIMA, like ACCA, who do recognize those universities within South Africa. So I think what we try and do as FACET is say there isn't only one career stream, and Nadine did talk to that. FACET is not only about chartered accountants. We're about other types of professional accountants. We're about stockbroking. We're about bookkeeping. We're about debt collecting. We do, however, work with SAICA, and we have on a number of interventions, and it's not in this annual report, where we worked previously with National Skills Fund funding to get the University of Fort Hare accredited. And if you've had an opportunity to look at our sector skills plan for next year, we've put in funding for a catalytic grant to work with Walter Sisulu University to get that accredited. And Bank CETA are currently working with SAICA to see if we can get the University of Zululand accredited by SAICA. So we are working with the professional body. It's not something that the CETA can afford to fund out of our own funds. We do not have that kind of money available, and we would need to rely on support from the catalytic and NSF windows. Ma'am, with regard to the question on a deficit, and is a deficit good for a CETA, what you'll see in a CETA's financials is that at the end of any particular year, there are funds left over in the CETA's bank account. And we tend to get a lot of negative publicity around that money because people equate funding in a bank account with unspent or unallocated money, which is not the case. The root cause of the reason for money being in the bank account stems back to the PFMA. The Public Finance Management Act clearly states that a CETA may not allocate money to a project that they don't have. So if we use FACET as an example, if we make a strategic decision to fund postgraduate learners who want to be chartered accountants on a 3-year intervention, we've got to have all of that money available on the day that we make that decision. So we might need to put 50 million rand aside on that day when we make that decision. The majority of that money is probably only going to be spent in 3 years' time when the young person is writing the qualifying exam. That money sits in our bank account for 3 years. What happens then, Madam Chair, is in year three, when we're spending year three's money at the same time, we actually end up spending all the money we allocated 3 years ago. So we end up spending this year more money than we actually got. But it's good because we're spending the money that was sitting around in the last 3 years. And that's why the deficit in a CETA environment is good, because it's showing you spending previous money. It is a huge concern, however, for CETAs, that the way the PFMA is written, because it does mean we tie up a whole lot of cash in projects that we can only spend the money much later. And we would really want to work closely with you to see if there's any way in which we can overcome this problem that all of the CETAs face, that we need to tie up so much money. It would be much better if we could utilize the money in a particular year and then allocate money from the next year to that 3-year project and then not have to have it in, on hold.
Just to check with you, you're saying on the current and where you're sitting, there isn't your reporting because it's money of projects that have come to an end.
That's correct, yes.
Then it's sitting as a deficit. Why is it not cleared? Is it a deficit?
No, it's
because what it means to me is that you are sitting with money, sort of over expenditure.
No, not at all. What it means is if you look in the statement, what we record as income is the amount of physical money the CETA got this year. So the CETA received 200 million rand of income this year. Included in the expenditure line item is the money we spent this year, which includes money we had from previous years, which is not in the income line because it was in the income line of a year before. The other way to look at it, Madam Chair,
sitting as a, what you call,
as a surplus. That's correct. That's right.
And then, okay, so the difference now, as it's reflecting as a net deficit of 13 million,
yes,
is because it's not allocated for financial year 09, 010, but it has been sitting.
That's correct, yes, okay. Madam Chair. Tracking of...
In the standard practices of accounting, there's no, what do you call, No. Money that is unspent, you can't call it a, what is it, surplus. There's no surplus.
No, I use the term, would call, we normally argue around that because that's what the CTS uses as a terminology. That's why I went back to their terminology, because that's what they use. And all others, I think I know the view of the committee around the issue of surplus, and
yes,
understand why honourable member is looking like that. But I just wanted to understand the specific scenario, hence I asked in terms of our goods. But then what I want to emphasize on that, where do we stand? Are you, because I'm a bit confused with what you are reflecting. Because what we want to see is for this financial year, in terms of what has been allocated, have you been able to spend all of it? And then, because this deficit, because you say it would be easier for me if I had previous records and I couldn't pick up that related to previous, otherwise I would have gone to other financial reports that you've presented for previous years to see that truly this money was there. So where I'm sitting, I'm relying on your weight. And this is a faith issue that Honorable Makubela does not like. To say, I'm relying on your faith in what you are saying, that the money you have spent is what you have, because I don't have anything that says to me where I'm sitting. That's the money. I'm not so sure maybe if the AG's office is able to assist me with this one. Because I'm sitting with a situation whereby we are saying they've spent money, which they have, but in the record says to us they've over in simple interpretation, is that they've overspent the money. I don't know if you are able to assist, but I need to have comfort that they did not spend what they do not have.
Madam Chair, it's not an unusual situation for the CETOS, because you would see that the CETOS projects run over a couple of years. So, and also in their financial statements, they have their commitments. So what would happen is in year one, they would receive levy income, which is obviously in their bank account. However, the projects for which that levy income will be allocated to will be in the next year. So in the next year, you will again receive levy income, but it might be lower than the previous year. Hence, you would, once you spend those money on those commitments, you would go into a negative, basically into a deficit. Because you have those funds available from the previous year in your discretionary reserve, which you can allocate to those expenditures. I don't know if that answers the question.
To Honourable Makubela and Honourable Faller, Vice President.
Chair, the other understanding is that if year one you're getting an allocation, commit all the money to project. And that part of that money is carried over to year two. In year two, you receive another allocation for other projects. To me, the 2 year or 3 year period will have accumulated, isn't it? So, now when you account per year, why does it look like you're spending money you don't have when it should have accumulated in the bank account?
Okay, let me try and answer this simple example.
Well, fund and then you'll come.
Chairperson, thank you. I take it what you say, that the PFMA makes it very difficult for you in this regard. And my question is, while we've got the presence of the Auditor General staff here today, in the case of expenditure, you've got a similar situation. There you would say, for example, you've got an impairment or you make provision for bad debts in the old language, etc. Now, my question is, to what extent can a state entity provide for commitments that they've already signed up for, but that will only be realizing in the next financial period or one day after? To what extent, because that is, I think, what we're after. We want to know, you know, what commitments have already been entered into, but that will only realize in a following financial year, so that we can get a better picture, because that's the whole issue of accountancy, is to give us a clear picture of whether we've got the necessary finances, etc. Mr. Castle, Mr. Robert. Thank you. I mean, this is your game. And surely, you know, we must find a solution to this, and I can't imagine that it would be impossible. I mean, apart from PFMA regulations, if you go under your general accounting practice, you've got solutions for this sort of problem. Is it something peculiar? Do we need to change, therefore, public accounting rules? Or cannot you be a bit more creative and come up within the rules with a solution?
I'm afraid creative and accounting are two words that don't go together. No, I think you've hit the nail on the head. There's ones that are generally accepted accounting principles for people like chartered accountants, and the PFMA has got a slightly different interpretation. And this point we're hitting on now is one of these areas of where PFMA interprets things slightly differently, and we have to therefore report in a different way. And I'm not an expert in the PFMA at all. I'm on the other side of the fence. I defer to the experts behind me. But it is an area, I wouldn't say of concern, it's an area of confusion that people who are not accountants often get confused by, and we just have to scratch our heads and say, sorry, there's a difference between the two acts and what's accepted. I'm terribly sorry. Have a cup of tea. No, there's not much we can do about it.
Just to say, maybe go to your financial information slide quickly. Yeah, so that when she speaks, it's on there. I just wanted to check something with you. So that when you respond to all everything. After just gender and I think.
Yeah.
No, not this one.
Okay.
financial. You know why I'm asking this? Shouldn't it have been better, maybe for us even to understand, when you reflected, like when you're speaking about STL income, and then shouldn't you have maybe reflected your previous surplus, so that by the time we see the net deficit, we understand what you're talking about? Because at least it would have, because that's how I would have maybe at least had, because you'd have said surplus from previous year, this is the amount, so that we are able to understand when we come to a net deficit. Because it just comes at the level of net deficit. When you look at all the others, it does not reflect that we have money that is sitting somewhere. Hence the question came. I don't know if you understand what I'm saying, yeah? Okay.
If I can refer to the members on page 44 of the annual annual report. Okay. On page 44. Madam Chair, if you look at the bottom of that page 44, under the note funds and reserves, and you look at the prior financial year, you see an amount of 71,754,000. 71,754. That is the reserve money that we had in terms of your understanding, the surplus money that we had accumulated over the last number of years. And that is what we've used up. And that's the reason why we have the 30 million. So in essence, what you're saying, that 70 million less the 30 million deficit for the current financial year is what you get to in terms of the 41 million rand. So we're saying we had 71 million rand of reserve money available in the previous financial year. Of that 71 million rand, we have used up 30 million rand to run the projects of the prior financial year. So in essence, we're saying that that money is there. We have the 71 million rand. We got approval from National Treasury to keep that 71 million rand, and we've now used that 71 million rand in the current financial year, which has reduced that money now to 41 million rand. So it's not money that we did not have. It's money that we have in the reserve account, which we've now used up. And I think
so you're saying that you have used 30 million and then you're left with 40, which is still a reserve. Okay, let me proceed.
Chair, thank you very much. Moving on to some of the other direct questions we had with regard to recognition of prior learning. We didn't include recognition of prior learning in our presentation, but all learnership qualifications within the FACET sector have got a recognition of prior learning component included in them. So we do make sure that we are engaged in recognizing what young people have done before as they want to progress. With regard to the training layoff scheme, there have been no claims that have come through the training layoff scheme process from any employers in the FACET sector. So we do get that report on a monthly basis from the CCMA, but it hasn't impacted on FACET at all because no organisations have been affected. With regard to new venture creation, we have included it in our annual report, and the way in which FACET has defined new venture creation is slightly different to the other CETAs. We count people in the new venture creation target who have completed their professional exams and have applied to become a practicing member of that professional body. Because once you are a practicing member, you have a license to practice, which means you can open your own organization. And that's what we track. We do not fund people who are wanting to start up their own practices. Because of the nature of the sector and the costs involved, we just don't have the financial resources to be able to assist people at that level. Lifelong learning at FACET is the common term used in the professional is continuous professional development or continuous professional education. So the kind of interventions that we are funding on the lifelong learning intervention would be an annual budget and tax update. So once the Minister of Finance has announced his annual budget, we would get professional tax presenters to look at that budget, to go around the country and to upskill all accountants in the country
in terms of the changes that is happening in that budget. So those are the kind of topics we would cover. We also do a compliance with legislation update every year. So, for example, this year there was a lot of focus on the Changed Companies Act, on King 3, that kind of thing. So it's taking people whose BCOMs are effectively with a 1 year of them finishing old already and upskilling them in what the changes are and what the legislative updates are. And as Nadine says, the importance of that is so that the practitioner out there can train the young person who's coming in behind them properly and to keep at the cutting edge of education. I think I've addressed all of the questions except the quality assurance partner question, and I'll ask Nadine to comment on that. Thank you, Chair.
Just quickly, within 5 minutes on this.
Thanks, Chair. The nature of the facet sector is the sector is characterized by professional qualifications. So most people that become trained in the sector have to link up with a professional qualification and therefore with a professional body. So we're talking about up to about 15 different types of professional bodies. I know that the common accountant that we always know about is a chartered accountant, but there's also cost and management accountant. There are bookkeepers, stockbrokers. There are fraud examiners and so on. So what we've done is that these professional bodies have always been involved in ensuring that the quality of their training remains at a certain standard. Obviously, because they're wanting those learners to come through as members that are meeting the correct standard. So what FACET did right at the beginning is instead of duplicating the quality assurance work that these professional bodies were already doing, we decided to partner with them and formally sign agreements with them where they would continue to do their work but align it to the quality assurance standards that have been set nationally by the South African Qualifications Authority. So it becomes a win-win situation. FACET is able to secure the quality and meet legislation, and the professional bodies are also able to ensure quality that leads to their professional membership. I just wanted to touch on a question around the career guidance and how we partner with certain people there. The important thing about the career guidance is to get to as many number of learners as possible, to get the information to them and in as many ways as possible. So there again, instead of us trying to do it on our own, we are trying to link up with organizations that already have a high success rate. I used Career Planet as an example, but Career Planet is effectively a website where learners can really go in and look up careers in any of the CETAs. So a lot of the CETAs will partner with that kind of organization instead of trying to set up only our own website or our own structures.
Thank you very much. I'm going to suppress the hands that I see rising. And ask members to bear with me. I still have the AG's office that we requested to interact with us on the issues that we raised with them. And take this opportunity to thank the team from FACET, CETA, led by the Chairperson Kappa, together with the Deputy Chair, with the Vice Chair. Memorably, we thank you very much. Ms. James and Ms. Kaita and Nakun for the presentation and the interaction. We'd obviously at some point come back and have some more interaction. There's a lot that we need to still engage on. What I would appreciate just if you can send through our secretary and the other side some detailed information on your RPS. What are the areas that you are appealing on? How much you're spending on that so that we can be able to follow up? We are, as the portfolio committee, interested quite a lot on that. We want to do an analysis across the sector in how the RPL is happening. So we'd appreciate that in that regard. But thank you very much for your time and the engagement and how you've been able to handle the questions and the response. We really appreciate it, and thank you. You're more than welcome to be excused for this part that you're dealing with. And I'll ask the AG's office maybe to come forward so that we can quickly deal with it. Members, we have even to deal with the minutes of the previous meetings.
as you know that this is almost like our last meeting. We didn't schedule anything unless there's an agency that would need to meet next week, but we'll alert members if there is as such before Friday. You should know if we do need to meet next week as the committee week. But we thought the year has been quite a very exhaustive year, a challenge, and therefore we thought that we shouldn't have a meeting next week because the House is rising this week. Honourable Van der Vlissen, and you wanted to say something?
Chairperson, thank you very much. Obviously, myself and my colleague, we weren't here when the committee drafted its strategic plans. So I was just wondering if we would be able to get copies of that, and also, you know, if, what we can expect next year, you know, what focus areas there will be. Has clarity already been gained on that, or how is that going to be determined?
What I'm doing, I know that NLS created a draft program, which I have not had an opportunity to input with, which I just did. One of the things I'm suggesting is to have a stretch session for a 2-day where we look at specific areas, but as well our view, what we want to achieve for the year. So that on those 2 days, you spend the first morning more or less on looking at what the committee would want to achieve for the year, review obviously what we have been able to look at, and I think that would be circulated to members. So that we can, normally would have to have you, the committee approving it. But because we have not finalized, and in light of not having a full-time chair, it's a bit of a challenge because you'd want to allow space for the chair appointed to have specific, would obviously guide based on what has been agreed throughout the year, the things that we, as we were interacting, for example, the issue of RPL session, we have agreed upon, the issues of how we interact with the NSC threat, we have agreed upon. So those things would be there, but you still want to have a space for the new chair to approve, to make inputs and sort of provide. That's why we're not having that program adopted now, and hence my indication that we might still have a meeting next week, depending if we are to get a chair appointed quite soon. If we're not, we're going to have, then we'll adopt that program next year. Over to you.
Did these short questions connected to Mr. Van der Westhuizen's question, because we've discussed it during the meeting, what he asked you. Does that include oversight visits also? And what was the other thing? Yes, next week's meeting will be obviously on Wednesday.
It's a committee week. I can't remember what happened. When is a committee week? Remember that we have...
It can even have Tuesday.
Yeah, we can have Tuesday. But that's what I'm saying, by Friday, we should be able to indicate, because we don't want to get, for example, that's something, the issue is that it's the program, it's all those things that we need to deal with. But I wouldn't want to lead that process and close down. I don't know if members understand what I'm trying to say. Allow space. But it doesn't stop members from suggesting certain things. If you want, you can suggest them through the secretary. And then when we come back, the chair and the committee would look at it and get it approved before we start implementing.
Does that also include, for instance, suggestions as to how we deal with our meetings in future, for instance, agenda beforehand or whatever? Does that include
The program includes the agenda items, because it should say on this day you're dealing with, for example, NSFAS on this issue. That's what it would say.
Yes. What I would like to suggest is that we should have in future a general point on the agenda if we want to add something. Is it possible or not?
Not at all. Mm-hmm. You would have to put it as an agenda so that it goes into notice, because the rules would...
That's what I mean.
Any general, anything that comes to the committee, members should have it in advance.
That's what I mean.
You can't put a general point.
But before the meeting, is it possible?
It's possible, because you need to circulate it to members through the chair,
and
then it can be put as an agenda item. Thank you. It's not. Honourable Dikop.
No. I would really plead that if a meeting is held next week, we should stick to Wednesday, because it affects other members' attendance in other committees. So as soon as you say Tuesday, some of us would be sitting elsewhere. So our day is Wednesday. If we are meeting, let's stick with Wednesday.
It doesn't, Cash, let me assure you. When it's committee week, your committees that normally meet on Wednesday meet on Tuesday afternoon. The ones that meet Tuesday would meet in the morning. It does that way. I've checked it very well. And the chairperson, normally I have requested to stick to that. And then because you have more days of meeting as committee. So committee week is that you'd have committee in the morning and afternoon. Wednesday committee morning and the afternoon. Because there wouldn't be a sitting, but it would never clash. Because what they've divided the committees is that there'll be group A and group B. So in group B is normally the committees that meet when it's session, parliament session, they'll meet in Wednesday. Group A is the ones that meet on Tuesday. So I can assure you. But would definitely notify members wouldn't if it happens, would want to have it on Tuesday. So that by Wednesday and others you can be out, because it doesn't necessarily mean that you can have people throughout the week for something. But I'm saying where I'm sitting so far, there isn't a need for a meeting for next week, yeah.
Will it be then Tuesday afternoon?
Yes,
specific.
Yeah. Are we ready? Not yet. Okay. Maybe, okay.
While we're waiting, can I just ask, I think there are some things which the committee might agree on, and that we would like to convey to the department. You yourself this morning raised that I think there's a general feeling that the targets that were set to the CETAs have been set far too low, and we made it too easy, or the department made it too easy for them. Now, if we as a committee want to take a decision like that, or to communicate that and other stuff as well to the department, when would that opportunity be for us as a committee to, in a sense, say to the department what our observations were during the exposure that we've now had to the CETAs. One other thing might have been our concern about the pay increases, the salary increases, and so on. Would there be an opportunity for us as a committee to just express ourselves so that we're not only sponges that year, but that we can also, you know, give back? Thank you.
Definitely. What happens, I think it's just a matter of scheduling that. But as well, because normally that's why you would raise these things. But the expectation is that the people who sit in the meeting, that's why I would reflect to Mr. Hoon on the issues he's left now, but on the issues when we interact, that's why it's the message that we send back. I think what we would have to do, for example, is as part of scheduling early next year, is to have an opportunity to reflect, as we reflect on the site plan, I think, as well, to reflect back on the year, what has been our achievement, what has been the issues, but as well, in scheduling, put those things on the agenda to come back and really drill down on those issues. I think one of the things that we have as a session that we must have is the NSD3 input as a committee towards the ministry. Because I remember even on the issue of the landscape, we had requested to interact with the minister on the landscape before announcement, and unfortunately it did not happen with that specific request, to be honest. And the issue now that you have made, and I'm hoping that the ministry, and I'm looking at Noctula here, would give us an opportunity to interact with them, the department, before they announce the NSDS3. Because that is important. But I've asked Anela to look at us when we have those threat plans, we have the input session within those 2 days, because we should have it within the first week that we are coming back, to really drill down on this issue and give him. Because I think from where I'm sitting, we do need a session with the ministry, with the department, to look at, especially our interaction and our observation on CETAs. That is quite important. There are a number of issues that have come up, not only on NSD, there are a number of areas that we have raised concerns, a number of areas that we think we should be able to look at. But a session like that with the department would assist portfolio committee, and I think that's one of the things that we must prioritize in the early year. We almost ready. Okay. Maybe while we come into the presentation, members of the AG, and we had requested the AG's office to come. Specifically, I noticed your presentation is long, and I'm going to tell you our interest on this matter, emphasizing on it. When we were interacting with the CETAs, we got worried somehow. We looked at about, can't remember them off my head, honestly. There were about 5 CETAs where you could pick up on your opinion that the finances had to be restated this year, and that got us worried. We tried to find some people who are sort of an opinion from somebody who deals with finances and all those things, somebody within Parliament around financial management, to say, are we correct to be worried about this? And the issue was that there could be possibilities. And once it admitted, when we asked for this, to say, is it because there are challenges of capacity within the CITES? That's why you end up with figures not corresponding and then having to reinstate? Or is it fraudulent activities that are happening? And once it admitted that, no, they had challenges of capacity, that the people who were dealing with their finances were not capacitated enough, and hence they have new staff that is going to deal with the finances that should improve, and those are the people who are trying to correct the finances. And we thought, let's interact with you, your offices, so that you understand what is it that you found as you were doing the CITES. Because we don't want to sit with a situation whereby we think all is well with the CITES, whereas there's things that we should be really worried about as a Bafulu community. So that's where the issue comes from. And I think Ms. Kau would know that we have already interacted with her when we were dealing with the initial stage. And she would have presented to us, but we thought that there's something that we should interact with as what it came up. It's not something that we thought would have been there, but we thought, let's just come to you and ask you to specifically maybe put our minds and our hearts at ease. Over to you.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Honourable Members. Just to put your mind at ease with regard to the lengthy presentation. I know that we have previously engaged with most of the members present here. We haven't officially engaged with the Portfolio Committee on Higher Education. What we have done with other portfolio committees was a training induction with regard to their audit process. And some of the slides, that's what it relates to, and we just putting them there so that you can note them and understand where we come from in relation to this specific issue of concern that the Portfolio Committee has raised. So during your own time, for your own notes, then you can go back to it. If we do touch on it, it will just be on a high level. And the one other thing that I want to mention, Madam Chair, is that with regard to the specific paragraph under emphasis of matter relating to restatement of corresponding figures, it could be because of a number of reasons, which Rink Krobler is the senior manager responsible for half of the CITES in the office. It is mainly due to errors, prior errors, and also reclassification also relates to errors, and the reason, he will deal with the reasons thereof. The other issue, you know, which is not a restatement but a misstatement, which you will not see in the audit report, is audit adjustment. I think you would have seen previously in our audit reports, we had a table which would say that there were material adjustments to the financials, which we didn't have in the 9-10 financial report. So if there was any material adjustments to the financial statements, these would not be reflected in the audit report. They would be reflected in the entity's management report, just to give an indication to managers, management and the board, that there is a concern with regard to the financial management within the entity. And as you have correctly stated earlier, we have found that in most instances is the issue of capacity, skills, the number of people in the finance unit, absolutely. And those issues, Rink will deal with them in detail. I believe that for the 10-11 financial year, we will state in the audit report those entities where there were significant adjustments to the financial statements, and the reason why we refer back to the previous induction slides, if I may say, is because one of the issues that has been raised in the email that we are required is to sort of indicate what sort of processes can be put in place to make sure that we address these. And we fall back on the fundamentals of internal control. And this also, Rink will go back, will go in detail on that, because one of the issues we're saying that most CETAs, they are on GRAP, which is an accrual basis of accounting, whereas on a monthly basis, they account on cash basis and they go on accrual at the end of the year, and therefore this raises a number of findings or misstatements that are picked up by the AG. So it is advisable that they compile complete and accurate financial statements on a monthly basis. I'll just hand over to Rink to go through the presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for this opportunity. The approach that I'll follow with the presentation is maybe those in slides that's more for information purposes. I'll maybe just briefly touch on them and then to go and drill down into the detail that the committee requested. Just on the first slide is basically just our reputation promise from the Auditor General side. As the Auditor General of South Africa has a constitutional mandate, and as the Supreme Audit Institution of South Africa, it exists to strengthen our country's democracy by enabling oversight, accountability and governance in the public sector through auditing, thereby building public confidence. So that's just our mission as the Auditor General of South Africa, basically to strengthen our country's democracy and to build public confidence. The next slide is with regards to the audit process. Basically just to say that we have engagement activities planning, then we perform the audit, and at the end we evaluate, conclude, and report on the audit process. The next slide is the accounting authority and Auditor General's responsibilities. Basically, like Matthew said, that the accounting authority is responsible for preparing the financial statements and implementing the necessary controls, basically to ensure that the financial statements is a fair representation of the matters at the entity, and also clear of fraud and error. And I think it's just important to note that that is management's responsibility to ensure that fraud and error is detected and also addressed. And then as Auditor General, we audit the financial statements, predetermined objectives, and also compliance with laws and regulations, and at the end express an opinion on that. The next slide I've basically addressed. With regards to internal controls, I'd just like to go through this in a bit more detail, because when it comes to those emphasis of matters that was raised with regards to corrections in the financial statements, these internal controls are basically what should be in place at the entity to address those matters so that it does not reoccur. I can also say from the Auditor General side, there's a detailed key control document that we've developed from our side. During the planning phase of the audit, this document will be completed for the current year. The expectation is that the chair of the board actually signs off this key control document, and then we'll also evaluate the entity during the interim and the final process on this document. So if I go through the internal controls, basically the first one that should be there is leadership. With regards to leadership, we emphasize that to the tone at the top, creating an environment that's favorable to good financial management and service delivery. Identify key controls aimed at achieving the organization's objectives and assessing skills and competencies of the finance staff. With regards to finance and performance management, it's basically complete, accurate, and complete monthly financial statements and also quarterly performance reports. Implementation of sound financial and performance management systems, having proper controls over documentation to ensure that it's easily and readily available, and operating basic internal controls for an efficient financial and performance management environment. With regards to governance, we're basically looking at the internal audit and audit committee's performance, and then maintenance of effective risk management strategies, including the fraud prevention plans. So those are basically all internal controls that should be in place at the entity, and if it's working effectively, it would basically address the concerns that the committee raised. The different audit opinions are just there for information purposes. Then with regards to emphasis of matter paragraphs, I must just emphasize that these paragraphs basically just highlight something that's already disclosed by the entity in their financial statements. And there's also other additional paragraphs, and these paragraphs included in the audit report basically address other matters in the whole annual report, which we would like to highlight to the reader of those financial statements. Clean administration. As the Auditor General, we have one of our targets is basically to have a clean audit opinions by 2014. A clean audit report means no qualifications on the financial statements, funding of predetermined objectives, compliance with laws and regulations, and internal control deficiencies. That's basically what we see as a clean audit opinion. From the AGSA side, we basically have our contribution to clean administration, basically with regards to simplicity, clarity, and relevance of our messages, and this flows through in our reports. And also with regards to the visibility of leadership, ensuring that we are at the entities when the audit is taking place and communicating with the leadership of that entity. CETA audit outcomes for 19. Basically, you'll see there has been a great improvement from 8.9 to 19. And what I'd like to go into in a bit more detail is basically the reasons for the improvements in the audit opinions from the AGSA side. Basically, that management and the board has taken corrective action to address prior year's findings, keeping to commitments and adequate plans in place. So basically, what we do is we assess the plans that the entities have in place to address the findings, ensuring that staff has the necessary skills and competence, having adequate policies and procedures in place, improving the general control environment at the entity, and also sound governance structures with regards to internal audit and the audit committee. So from our side, these were what we felt was the major contributors to the improvements in the audit opinions. With regards to predetermined objectives, which is all performance information, there was 5 CETAs that had findings on that in 8.9 and 6 in 9.10. With regards to predetermined objectives, we did not express an opinion in the audit report on predetermined objectives. It was limited to the management letter. What we've reported in the audit report was only significant findings, and I'll go through the findings that we reported just now. And with regards to laws and regulations, there were 10 CETAs in 8.9 that had findings on that in the audit report, and for 9.10 there was only 5. Although this is a significant improvement, it's still a concern because that should actually and be zero. There shouldn't be any non-compliance with laws and regulations. In as per the committee's request, we focused on emphasis of matter paragraphs. Like Matthew stated previously, the emphasis of matter paragraphs is basically to highlight something that's already in the annual report. The material amendments to the financial statements for the current year was only limited to the management letters. But what I've done is I've had a review of the management letters, and there was actually 10 CETAs that had material amendments to the financial statements after it was submitted for audit purposes. The following emphasis of matters were reported: restatement of comparative figures. Basically, that is the reclassification of amounts or prior period errors identified or detected and corrected in the current year. But I think it's just important to note that the way these errors were detected could have been from various sources. Basically, one is through our audit process that we pick up something during our current year that relates to the previous year, and then the entity is given that opportunity to correct it. Or it can be due to the fact that the entity itself is improving on its internal controls, whereby it is picking up these errors from the previous years. other emphasis of matter paragraphs raised is significant uncertainties with regards to pending litigation. And at that stage, when we issued the audit report, some CETAs were also possibly going to be placed under administration. Irregular, fruitless, and wasteful expenditure was raised for 10 of the CETAs. Material losses through criminal conduct was raised for 3 of the CETAs. And financial sustainability and going concern was raised for 1 of the CETAs. The committee previously spoke early on about the deficits and whether there's funding available. So what we are saying here with this last one, going concern and financial sustainability, is there was actually 1 of the CETAs that was overcommitted and was had a deficit. So basically whether they will be continuing as a going concern at this stage when the report was issued was still in question, hence it was raised in the audit report as emphasis of matter. Then going forward, basically how to address these emphasis of matter paragraphs and findings in the audit report, it basically comes down to the internal controls that I've raised previously. If those internal controls are present, there's a sound internal control environment, these matters should be picked up. I know a lot of the CETAs have started with the monthly financial statements now, which I think is a good process because then come year end they only have to do 1 month financial statements. And also when we come in for our interim audits, we can already look at those financial statements. Then areas that might impact the audit reports in future, and this is also quite important for this committee from our side. I was actually quite pleased to hear the committee identifying that the CETAS targets might be set too low and raising that as a concern, and also the measuring of impact that the CETAS have in their environment. What we've raised is areas that might impact the audit reports in future, especially the new CETA landscape. Currently, that there isn't clarity on the process that will be followed with the new CETA landscape, how the CETAs will be closed down or consolidated, and how the different employer groups will be moved from one CETA to another. So that's just one of our concerns, especially when we come in for the, our final audits also of the year end, because this will take place from 1st of April. So if we come in May, June, July for the audits, whether those documentation will still be available. Then secondly, predetermined objectives. Like I said, currently we're only expressing an opinion in the management letter. So going forward, this might also impact the audit reports of the different CETAs. The material findings that was raised for 19 was, for some of the CETAs, adequate supporting documentation was not available for what is reported in the annual report. Adequate policies and procedures not in place. Adequate systems to monitor and report on predetermined objectives are not in place. Specifically with regards to performance information. The information reported was not accurate, and then also a lack of skills specifically with regards to predetermined objectives. And then NSDS3, what we've identified with regards to NSDS2 is the targets are basically numbers based. So it does not really measure the impact going forward, and I know the member raised also when your concern should be reported to the department, and it actually should be as quickly as possible because they are in the process of finalizing an SDS3. And then into the second bullet that it is basically critical that the targets that are set now also comply with the National Treasury Framework for Managing Program Performance Information. This framework is also available on National Treasury's website, but it's basically critical that those targets that are set comply with this framework as well. And then previously the members also alluded to this, but a special consideration with NSDS3 should be given to the medium-term budget policy statement that was made, especially with regards to the CETAs, the 5 million jobs over 10 years that government wants to create. Effective training programs should be strengthened across the public sector, delivering on outputs and activities and making policy priority to service delivery and goals that are more measurable and more exact. So that's actually quotes from the medium-term budget policy statement that's really relevant for the CETAs and also for NSDS3, and then also compliance with laws and regulations. The horizontal audit approach, this is an approach that we started for, which is specifically for all departments and public entities. For the entities, it's specifically with regards to supply chain. We've also extended our procedures in this year with regards to our horizontal audit. So these procedures that we are doing with regards to supply chain might also have an impact on the audit reports in future. And also the irregular, fruitless, and wasteful expenditure that has been incurred, that the process needs to be looked at to ensure that everything is all laws and regulations are complied with to ensure that irregular expenditure is not incurred. And that's basically that from our presentation side. I don't know if there's any specific questions from the members.
Members, I have Member Gogo from the and Member from the Minister.
Thank you, Chairperson. Like the Chairperson has said, this issue of restatement of corresponding figures. Our understanding is that we are saying in the last presentation the figures were not correct. Now you are correcting them now. But the question that, because we were raising these questions to the CEOs or Chairperson, but we tend to think that maybe we should ask the Auditor General, does it mean that you were not able to pick up? Because if the figures were restated at the time that you audited, you know, it may even be that these people got a clean audit. You said everything was correct, but you come the following year and say, no, I'm restating. What are the issues there?
Thank you, madam. My concern is not so much an audit concern, but the process of the CETAs that know that they must be wrapping up their books over the next 4 months. We've seen here that with a little bit uncertainty of the CETAs, some CETAs have given their CEOs raises of 41%, 21%, all aboard, all the staff members got on average 21% increase with the CETA we saw this morning. Now, if you have, you know, clarity that you're going to close your books, what safeguards do we have in terms of legislation, in terms of your audit processes, etc., that people won't be helping themselves to what is left in the purse or the wallet at this point in time, that the assets will be protected. You know, I fear things like, such as laptops being sold to staff at, you know, low values, suddenly long service bonuses being agreed upon by the boards, etc. Is there anything that we can do to make sure that the assets, which I believe are public assets, are protected, and that it will be, you know, put to best use, that whoever will decide on that will not take into account the immediate interests of the people involved, but the interests of training and the public sector as far as that is concerned. Is this something that protects, you know, those ideals that I've set? Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Honourable Chair, for you. In response to Honourable Member's question on whether we would have missed the misstatement relating to previous year, the specific reason why we gave a detailed presentation on the responsibility, management responsibility and audit responsibility is exactly to address that specific issue. When we go in and do the audit, our audit is on a sample basis. So we do not audit each and every transaction. So yes, it could be that we have missed certain transactions that could have been misclassified, or that could have resulted in errors. And as a result, you find that there is prior year errors. And
in relation to that is this audit adjustments that we are talking about, that during the audit, if we pick up audit adjustments, then the entity will then correct the financials accordingly. The other issue that we need to take into account is that during the audit process, when we pick up an audit, it's based on the sample of the population. So we didn't audit the whole population, we audited the sample. What we then do is extrapolate, which means we reflect on the sample represents 20% of the population. Now, if we convert this error into the whole population, will this be material or not? And then the entity must then go back and correct the whole population so that we can then express an opinion. And unfortunately, this wasn't done in those previous years. So if we get an error from the sample, then the entity will then correct that sample and not necessarily the whole population. And when they go into the new year and interrogate further, they find that the rest of the population might have had certain amounts of errors, and then they correct them. But at the same time, the obligation is with management to put in place controls to make sure that their financials are complete and accurate on a monthly basis, as we have indicated that going forward, there is a necessity for the executives and the board to commit to capacitating the entities and all the units within the entities with appropriate skills to be able to then deliver what is required by each and every unit in the entity. If we go to the next question, with regard to what the portfolio committee can do to make sure that the assets are safeguarded, particularly with regard to those sitters that are closing down. I think it's a critical point that the honourable member is raising. And with continuous engagement with the sitters and the department, and engagement, I mean interrogation of the reports that are presented to and decisions, critical decisions that are made by the board, should come to the portfolio committee so that the portfolio committee knows what the entities intend to do with those assets and if it's in line with legislation. I believe there is high-level guideline in terms of what entities can do with the assets that are in the entities when they close down, and those decisions must be made in line with the legislation. And I think the portfolio committee is situated in a better position to be able to do that in-year monitoring of what is happening within those entities, obviously via the department or with the entities themselves, particularly. And I think it links back to what my colleague has said earlier, that we need to see a transitional plan in terms of what is going to happen by 31 March when these entities are closed down, because we still need to audit those entities. And if they're going to transfer from the 1st of April to new seekers or to other seekers, then will there be somebody from April to July for us to conduct the audit? So those are the transitional arrangements that need to be put in place. And I agree that engagement with the department and the entities is critical in that regard. Absolutely. There are risks, documentation, risks. Let me give a hypothetical example. MedCita is transferring certain pieces to two different CETAs. where will the documentation be for us to audit from an audit perspective? And absolutely, which assets, which employers are going to transfer to which CETA? Are there processes in place to make sure that from the 1st of April, these transfers happen smoothly?
Just one thing from my side, what is also important is for the committee to note is that the commitments and learnerships don't stop 31st of March. They are continuing. So the processes that's put in place to take over those commitments and also those learnerships by the new CETA is also critical.
Thanks, Honourable Chair, members. Just on this last question, what I would like to convey to the Portfolio Committee is that the Department has already started with a process. Now, even prior to the announcement of the Minister, the Department has already engaged with these affected CETAs, you know, in the sense of meeting with their boards, as well as meeting with, you know, the CEOs. And on the day of the announcement of the Minister, we basically informed those affected CETAs that a steering committee must be established that will consist of the department, the relevant chairpersons or office bearers of the CETAs, as well as the CEOs. Now, the department has already also developed terms of reference, you know, to deal with this whole process, because I also would like to inform the committee that this is not the first time that the department is doing this, because in 2005, the minister then amalgamated four CETAs, and I must say, with these processes, it all went well, and we're quite positive that with our processes and what we are doing currently, it will also be successful with our experience as well as legislation. I can maybe just mention the minister also published, in terms of Section 9A, a notice where it's indicated now that it's going to amalgamate these CETAs and that there will be processes and that this new CETA will be established on the 1st of April 2011. Now, specifically Section 9A provides for so-called transitional provisions and what must happen and who will be responsible at the end of the day. Now, I can also maybe lastly just mention that in the past, I'm not sure if Macy and our colleague, if they were there when we amalgamated those four CETAs, but the AG was also by then involved, and I must say they really assisted us a lot, you know, specifically when it comes to the annual reports, financial statements, and those type of things. And we've already indicated in our terms of reference that they will also be a key player. So that's just shortly, Madam Chair, what we are currently doing. So we are already moving on this. I can also just mention our first steering committee meeting will be on the 26th with all the stakeholders. That's next Friday. Thanks, Madam Chair.
What I'm going to request, I just noted, we are going to request a proper briefing to the Portfolio Committee from the Department on the process and the implication and how you're dealing with the risks. I think we'll schedule that with the time with the Secretary. I think if you can start working on that.
Well, just a quick clarifying question. Can I just ask, so the CETAs are being amalgamated. No CETA is going to be closed, because for me there's a little technical difference between the two, which may be very important in terms of responsibility. If two CETAs amalgamate, I mean, I know where the responsibility is going. But when it's closed, I don't know who can be kept responsible after that. So, and my understanding is that the minister's statement said of, you know, these CETAs will cease to exist, which I interpreted as them being closed down.
Now, what is happening, Mr. van der Wezen, quickly, is that there are CETAs that are going to remain the same. There are those that are going to be amalgamated. There are those ones that are not going to exist anymore. So what would happen is that in that process of the briefing, we'd ask them to clarify especially the ones that are being amalgamated and the ones that are being closed down. For example, the next city that is going to transfer responsibility to different cities, and the ones that are taking more new responsibilities, the impact where there are changes. So that it's clear in terms of the process. I think that should be done properly because they are in different stages. There are those that nothing would happen in terms of the responsibilities. They remain the city. I think there we are fine. But where there's amalgamation, where there's a closure completely, that's what we should be worried about, and I think that's where it's going to happen. And if you look, I think the first part on that media statement, the first ones, that, I don't know how many are they, they're the ones that are not really affected, and they differentiate them from substantive impact and less substantive impact. When you look at it, those would have slight changes, those would have huge changes, those ones would not have a change at all. But I think when the presentation happened, we should dwell on all those, clarifying this one, we're not worried there would be nothing happening. This one, this is what would be happening. All those things should be able to assist us when we do that interaction. Members, I just want to thank from the AG. I think what you have given us, because we wanted to be sure in where we stand, in our opinion, in where we're raising issues, so that we are able to dwell with, follow up correctly. So because we're not interacting with the sitters for the first time or the last time, we'll be continuing to interact with them. And some of those things, those are the things that we need to pick up and be able to dwell on them when we interact. But we didn't want to leave the issues. And I know that you've never had the opportunity to interact with the committee. And I'm thinking that we have had interactions. Maybe it's based on other committees. And when we had a joint meeting, remember we had a joint meeting on basic and higher education that dealt with the Department of Education. And based on that, I think maybe that's why my mind is telling me that you've interacted with the committee. But it doesn't mean that this is the last time. We'll obviously interact with you in a number of areas where we need your assistance and in dealing with that. And especially with the realignment of status, I see us interacting quite a lot when we pick up issues that are of concern for us that we need you to assist with our opinion. We'll definitely still dwell on that one. And thank you very much. I know it was short notice that we called you, but thank you very much for coming through and sort of putting our minds at ease. Thanks a lot, and you're more than welcome to the show. Members, I know that we are starting to run out of time. We're supposed to have finished already by now. We have several sets of minutes that we are going to deal with. I think it's, the first one is the minutes that of the 25th of August. And then there's a report for the third and fourth, the one that we visited, the FEC visitor. And then the 1 September, the 8th September minutes, the 14th September, the 20th September, and then the last report on the amendment, laws amendment, which Anneli didn't put date, and I'm hoping it's going to put date. And members, and I'm taking that you have read the minutes. So I'm going to start with the first set of minutes, the 25th of August, 2010. And on that meeting, I noted that Honorable Van der Westhuizen, you were not present, so you wouldn't be able to give me adopt or, yeah. Members, anything on those minutes? And I'm saying members have read the minutes, and if there are no issues, can I have movers? We're going to go page by page. Honorable Dikobo move. Seconda. The people who are there, Honorable Makubela and Moshwana, rely on me. Honorable Makubela seconds the minutes should be adopted for the 25th of August 2010. Second set, I'm relying on Honorable Moshwana and Honorable Gina, but noting that the most person we are going to rely on this report is Honorable Moshwana, because she's the only one who's paid until the end of the session. Anything on this report? Honorable Moshwana?
On the
1st
of September, right?
The draft report, or what did I say? Oh, sorry, 1st of September, yes, you're right. I made a mistake. 1st of September, no, Honorable Dina, Honorable Igo, Honorable Moshwana, and myself were part of that meeting. So I'm relying on those, and I'm sharing, so I can't move. Honorable, the 1st September 2010, good option. Anything on those? Honorable Hatte, you're not part of that meeting.
Chairperson, I attended all the bills meeting, and I've noticed that the secretary of the committee usually forgets to put my name. If you have noticed in regular meetings, only at top minutes, my name is not there.
Anele, will you correct that for the 1st of September? That's what you're saying. Yeah, because there isn't even an apology for you. And the member is saying was present. So he's going to check the attendance. Unless if you are not signed in the attendance register, member had it. That's why you would not reflect. So we'll check the register and correct it and make sure that you're reflected. Anything on the minutes as well? Honorable Mushani.
Thank you. I'm on page 5. I'm checking if before this particular meeting we didn't talk of APEDS subtracting the deed and saying it's now adult education training. I just want to check because I see it's adult. Is it supposed to be still APEDS or AIDS?
I'm trying to follow you. I can't follow you.
Yeah,
you
thank you. Follow me. That's
yeah. Because the minutes reflect two things. They reflect the discussion around ABET, that the committee was concerned that we have moved from ABET to AET.
Yeah.
That was the discussion, I remember quite well. So I'm not so sure what you are correcting.
No, my neighbor is showing me that there is IET on top there.
Mm.
Because down the line I was seeing ABET. So I think it's fine. So I would move on for adoption. I wanted that clarified.
Okay. Member Mushana moves. Second line. Honorable Puna seconds. So the minutes for the 1st September duly adopted. We come to 8th of September minutes. We must come to the report of the 3rd and 4th panel. You are now, the report that I said that Honorable Mushwane is the one who was going to. I've looked at the part of where I was part. I didn't have anything. But Honorable Mushwane, if there's anything in the entire report, if you can assist us.
That's a hand, not mine. Were you ready? No, thank you. I wouldn't say I see any challenge right now. I would
move
like
for the adoption.
And I wouldn't like to be seen the shoot anything can be done, but I would move for the adoption of the
punishment. Honorable Gina, I'm relying on you for seconding. Oh yeah, even Honorable Jigobo was there. Yeah. So you are agreeing that you can move. Okay. The record of the 3rd to 4th September has been duly adopted. On the minutes for the 8th September 2010, I just have corrections or something addition on page 1, where it starts with, she informed the committee that the purpose of the meeting was to consider, so we need to add to consider the 3 pieces of legislation, which follows into the next page. Anything else, members? Can I have mover for the adoption of the minutes of the 8th of September? You are also part, Honorable Khadebe is requesting that he be included today. As he said, that all meetings which dealt with the legislation were there. Can we get a mover for the adoption? Honorable Makubele is moving. Seconder? Honorable Khadebe is seconding. We move to the minutes of the 14th of September, 2010. Again, here, Honorable Khadebe is not included. He attended. may correct that. It's all the bills. I do not pick up anything. Anything, members, on this? If there's nothing, can I get mover for the adoption? Honorable Makubela, move. Seconda. Honorable Dina, second. Minutes of the 20th of October 2010. I did not pick up anything on this minute. Anything, members? Can I get mover? Honorable Dikoba move. Second, Honorable Mushwana, second. Minutes should be adopted for 20th October. And then the last report is on, it's a draft report of the Portfolio Committee on Higher Education and Training on the public hearings on higher education laws. I'm requesting Anele to put the dates because there were meetings that we said to reflect as the report needs to reflect that. Anything else, members, on that report? You have been included on this one, Honorable Khatib. Can I get a mover for the adoption? Honorable Dikobo moves. Seconder. Honorable Makubela, second. Thank you very much, members. In that note, all the reports have been adopted. As I said, when we were still waiting for the Auditor General, members, we will not adopt the program for now until there's a chair in place to allow the chair to deal with the program. It has been circulated, members. I know you have. There will be changes. For example, I will just highlight that we will not only deal with UNISULU only as SRC, we might as well invite others that we think might need help and interaction. And then I highlighted the issue of the two-day strat plan and also, members, the issue of a study tour which needs to be included. The portfolio committee is due to travel between January and February early next year. It's in that group that is going to travel. But that information is included in the program that is going to be adopted by the committee as final and allowing the chairperson to finally look at that issue. And we'll communicate if this needs to be done next week, as I said earlier on, we'll do that, we'll communicate with members. That concludes the agenda for today's meeting, and the meeting is adjourned. Thank you very much, members.